from 11 stakeholders, written submissions. So it's a full day, and we have to be very businesslike and to the point. Speak to your documents. I tried my best to work through everyone last night. Since we received it, very interesting. Let your voice be heard, as we said in our advertisements. So today is where stakeholders are talking to us. We're not taking any decisions today, because we can't, in terms of the rules of the NCOP. And this meeting is conducted in terms of the rules. Shulani, there's a lot of ants on this table. Yeah. Dealing with three pieces of legislation, the carbon tax, tax bill section 77, legislation, the customs and excise amendment bill, section 75 legislation, and lastly, the PIC amendment bill, which is a committee bill. Comes from the committee in the National Assembly, the Standing Committee on Finance, which is a section 75 bill. With that introduction, over to our first presenter, the Airlines Association of South Africa, in Flying First. You are on for 15 minutes. I'm going to time you, and I'm going to stop you after 15 minutes. You've got time until 10:18. Thank you.
Honourable Chairman,
just introduce your team.
Yes. Honourable Chairman of the Committee and honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege to be here to present our views on the carbon tax bill. My name is Chris Swagenthal. I'm the Chief Executive of the Airlines Association of Southern Africa. I've got next to me Mr. Sandile Chapunza from IATA and our colleague advisor, Mr. Lyndon Burns, as well. The Airlines Association of Southern Africa is an industry association representing its members on issues of mutual interest across the airline spectrum. We have our interest as the long-term sustainability and profitability of our industry, and one of the mandates that we talk to is on the environment and climate change. So that's the reason that we're here. I've just shown you a list of the airline members, which is part of the main submission that we did make to the committee. We did make a full submission to the committee in a written submission. So our airlines are all the airlines of South Africa, the commercial scheduled airlines of South Africa, as well as majority of the airlines, the SADC member, SADC airlines, those in the SADC region. We also have industry associate members, which are all the aircraft manufacturers, engine manufacturers, and industry partners and service providers within that add value to the airline industry in our region. I think it's important to start, sorry, it seems to have cut off a little bit there. It's important to just highlight the importance of the airline industry in its essential role it plays in the economy of South Africa. It's important to understand that we believe that we add and facilitate economic growth and social economic growth to the country. There's through the activities we promote investment and facilitate trade and promote tourism, which creates a huge number of skilled and sustainable jobs. And we also foster skills development and innovation through advancing technology and a competitiveness. As you know, the airline industry is a very competitive industry. I think to bring our views on the carbon tax bill into context, it's important to look at the international context. South Africa is a signatory and a founding member of the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, which effectively regulates the worldwide and global aviation business. ICAO's view on taxes is that it supports incentives, not taxes, and in fact has a document which encourages all states who are signatories to eliminate and not add additional taxes to international aviation. We do recognize that there is a process whereby domestic aviation is not subject to ICAO, but ICAO does promote the fact that we should align international and domestic aviation, and that is reflected in our civil aviation regulations in South Africa, where the international standards and recommended practices are driven down into our civil aviation regulations. So effectively, ASA Airlines Association, together with the entire community, supports the reduction of carbon emissions through an incentive approach, which is carbon offsets and not through carbon taxes. The concern that we would like to just highlight regarding the carbon tax is that It's stated in the documents that carbon taxes is intended to change future behavior rather than raise revenue, but there's no indication how that's going to be achieved, and we do not believe that taxes change behavior. There's no indication how this money will, the carbon tax will be, as it goes into the fiscus, will be ring-fenced and go into the emission reduction program. The indication is it will not be able to be ring-fenced because it goes into the fiscus. And our concerns are that if it was to be able to be done, that would be far better, that we'd be able to have programs that are identified, scrutinized, validated, managed to actually achieve emission reduction, not just generation of taxes, which could be put into other means, whether it is to help, for example, state-owned enterprises that are having difficulties, for example, at this moment in time. What input and role would aviation industry have to determine this? We believe that we should have an input. And aviation therefore supports carbon offsetting programs for emission, for effective emission reduction, which is our prime objective. The harmful consequences of a carbon tax is that costs for administering collection of taxes will be passed on to the users. There's no other way to do that. And that will mean that airfares and cargo charges will increase. We'll also push up the cost of doing business, and that will effectively undermine South Africa's competitiveness. In my documents, in the submission, I make the point of how the domestic airline industry could be at a disadvantage to its international competitors. This could lead to diminished trade revenues, and that obviously leads to job losses, and that's something obviously that South Africa, we believe, is very intent on not having. We want to create jobs. We believe this will be a means to induce job losses. And that would obviously lead then to a reduction in income tax and other contributions to the fiscus, and then definitely be an impediment to economic growth. So the question is, what if we look at carbon offsetting versus a carbon tax? And the key factors in favor of offsetting is that offsetting is and the results of that, and we'll talk about the international solution, was an outcome of broad consultation and guidance by the UN and other bodies, globally recognized scientific and environmental organizations that have led to the solution. It's definitely, in our view, a less administrative burden than a carbon tax solution. It effectively achieves emission reductions, and there are certainly other social, environmental, and economic benefits that would be there to ensure that we try and move towards sustainable development. Key factors against carbon taxes are the reduced demand for air transport and connectivity, which is detrimental to the economy. We control investment in new technology and newer, cleaner equipment. As I mentioned, it'll have a negative impact on jobs. There's no ring fencing for revenue, and effectively limited impact, if any, on the environment. So international flights are exempted from carbon tax, and that's been accepted by the South African government. So domestic flights at the moment are earmarked for carbon taxes, but we believe that they should be exempt. Because we believe that, as I mentioned, that there's domestic flights will be their competitiveness will be undermined, and you'll obviously, by doing that, reduce taxpayers' return on investment in, say, for example, South African Airways and South African Express, which are going through difficulties, we all know, and you obviously reduce the impact that they could have by having a further burden on them and further burden on the taxpayer for taxes. And then also would obviously reduce the return on investment for private sector airlines. The aviation industry has done its bit in terms of cutting emissions. The fuel is up to 35% of operating costs. And the issue is that to reduce fuel means reduced emissions. And obviously, the lower the reduced fuel burn, the lower the cost, the lower the fares, the lower the cargo charges, which is good for business and then good for our economy. So I'd just like to hand over to my colleague from IATA, Sandile Chipunda, just to talk on the international aspects. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members, and stakeholders. IATA is an industry body representing the world airlines, 83% of the global airlines. So the actions that have been taken in an aggressive manner by the industry are as follows. We have three goals that we are pursuing in terms of reduction of carbon footprint. First goal, which we are on track for, is 1%, 1.5% reduction on average fuel efficiency improvement from 2009 to 2020. Goal two is to stabilize net aviation emissions at 2020 levels with carbon neutral growth. And the third one is to reduce aviation's net carbon emissions to 50% of what they were in 2005. And we're going to do this through the use of technology, operations, improved ways of flying, improved infrastructure, and market-based measures. So aviation is a world leader in cutting emissions, so fuel, improving fuel efficiency. We know that aircraft have improved between 15 and 20% on fuel efficiency, given the new generation aircraft that are in operation today. When we look at CORSIA in 2016, ICAO adopted the carbon offsetting and reduction scheme for international aviation CORSIA, and the international standard is to implement CORSIA were adopted by the annex to the Chicago Convention, and all 192 states in ICAO must apply this from 1 January 2019. It is forecast that CORSIA will mitigate around 2.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide between 2021 and 2035, which is an annual average of 164 million tons of carbon dioxide. And lastly, as of 15 January 2019, 78 states, including 10 in Africa, have volunteered for CORSIA. This represents 76.63% of aviation activity. While all flights are subject to MRV requirements since 1 January 2019, flights between volunteering states will become subject to offsetting requirements from 2021.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandile. So our view, Mr. Chairman, is that domestic policy must be aligned with the international framework, and we propose a solution for domestic aviation aligned to the CORSIA, which my colleague Sandile has talked about. This will avoid regulatory fragmentation between domestic and international activity, as well as other schemes around the world. It will reduce administrative complexity and facilitate the effective emissions reduction and for efficient air transport and achieve what we need to do, and that's reduce emissions. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, aviation, we believe, opens up and connects the world, and it supports markets. It's a job creation driver. It's a key contributor to GDP together with its associated industries such as tourism. It's critical to South Africa's economic development. And a carbon tax on domestic aviation, we believe, will curb economic growth and be harmful and not harmful emissions. We believe that incentives, which we have shown and Sandile has talked about, have already shown that we're delivering extensive emission reductions on this, on our process. So our recommendation, Mr. Chairman, is that the carbon tax bill must be amended to exclude domestic aviation, and we believe that we will contribute as well to the whole question of emission reduction through that. And government and research bodies, policymakers and regulators to industry must be engaged further to look at pragmatic, economically beneficial and effective carbon emission reduction solutions. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Will you please mail that document to Jolani, because it's easier to read.
Okay. Sure.
It's much easier to read, and one can memorize it.
Sure.
I'm very interested in this. Yeah. Thank you for the association, Airlines Association. You were well within your time. The next one is the Association for Cementitious Material Producers on the Carbon Tax. Are you ready? There you are. Welcome to the members that joined us. Honorable Mutla Shipping and Honorable Zamandi. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, we've got your hard copy. We can follow you if there's a turbulence on your system. You'll have to speak to your hard copy, and members, we are going to follow the document. There's a problem with the laptop and connecting. Yeah, please call IT, let them come. They must always be here. When finance is meeting, they must always be here. Yeah. There we go. You see, women's got a specific touch. Yes. Absolutely right. Thank you. Proceed.
Thanks. Okay. Morning. Thanks, Chair and honourable members present. And delegates. I'll be briefly giving an overview on the impact of the carbon tax on the cement sector. I come from the Association of Cementitious Material Producers, and we represent the major cement producers in the country. Some of them have international offices and international, and they are just branches around here. And basically, I think who we are an association that ensures that all our members prescribe to good environmental stewardship, good health and safety practices, and also have community and stakeholder interaction at a high level. So we really champion sustainable development amongst our members and strong involvement with the neighboring communities. Now, in terms of climate change and CO2 emissions, I think the above graph that you can see on the screen certainly reflects our commitment long before the legislative processes in the country. This graph shows our GHG emissions trend from 1999 to 2016. It hasn't been updated to the latest numbers. We're still busy with the numbers. But we've certainly decreased the levels of emissions without any regulatory framework, simply because we wanted to proactively respond to climate change. Our members believe in climate change, and they believe there should be active response to it. So I think this clearly demonstrates that one doesn't necessarily need a regulatory framework, but a commitment to environmental stewardship. In terms of cement production, what is key to note is it's a key sector in terms of infrastructure development to support our national developmental plan and goals, and the demand is directly linked with government spending targets on infrastructure projects and related housing projects as well. The cement producers have a specific challenge. The first thing is the bulky commodity, so it has to be transported all over the country. It has very low value. The profit margins are very, very small. The facilities are mainly regionally based near limestone mines. So that increases the transport costs. Up to 20, it could be anything from 8 to 20%. So there's already a challenge in terms of logistics. Then cement quality and integrity has to be maintained with strict SABS standards, because we don't want infrastructure to collapse on our and our dam walls collapsing as well. So it's quite important there's a sufficient emphasis placed on cement quality. It's also very capital intensive. The cash flow return on investment is about 2 to 5%, which is very, very low. International benchmarks is 8%. So we can already see that the cement sector has large cost drivers in the country. It's also very energy intensive. Up to 50 to 20% of cement production is related to energy costs in terms of coal use and electricity. And obviously because of that, high energy as well as the chemistry of the limestone, we are considered a key emitter in the country. Another important challenge we have, which is not related to production, is there's a significant oversupply of cement in the market. So if you look at the next graph later, you would see we have a production capacity of about 18 million. We produce about 14 million. There's over a million currently being imported from Pakistan, China, etc. So it's quite a challenge. Over the period, there's also been a decrease in price of cement. So as you can see, that's another challenge. The price of commodity is decreasing, the expenses are increasing, and that's a major challenge in terms of the survival of the sector. So the graphs, again, in terms of price absorption capacity, it's a major challenge. I've reflected on the capital-intensive nature of the industry. The electricity costs are just rising. We've just heard another rising cost recently. Energy cost, coal is going up, electricity is going up. The price of cement coming down, labor is going up. The logistics is going up in terms of fuel costs. So the key question is, will we be able to absorb, in addition to the current electricity cost already, another carbon tax? It's a major challenge. So we believe that if you look at this graph, these are real numbers. It's all showing upwards in terms of cost to produce and downwards in terms of price, sale cost of production and sales price. It's a major challenge to the industry. If you look at the next graph in terms of the landscape, the profits are decreasing tremendously. So the key question, and this is graphs of all our members, they're all going downwards in terms of profits. The question is, well, is this industry actually sustainable at present? We've heard of the electricity, which is going up 1920 by 13.82%. This is already posing a major challenge to our sector. So the cost to do business, this hike of electricity is already a major concern to energy-intensive industry, and I'd like to add that it's not only cement, it's probably the steel industry as well, iron and steel industry. They might have similar scenarios. I know they have submitted some comments, but they're not here to present it. The additional carbon tax burden and associated mitigation costs to comply with allocated carbon budgets will have major socio-economic consequences, both to regional and national economic development due to job losses and cheap imports. Now, this is quite important because in addition to the carbon tax, once we start paying, remember we also need to submit pollution prevention plans to demonstrate how we're going to reduce our emissions. That also has a significant cost. It's hundreds of millions of rands to put in different equipment to have change in technology. So in addition to tax, we've got to allocate money there as well. So that's another cost that will need to be absorbed. So our members are really concerned about their survival. The socio-economic impact, as I said, is regionally based. Now let's give an example of Lichtenberg. Most of our limestones is mined in the Lichtenberg area, which is in the northwest province. The entire town of Lichtenberg is driven by the cement sector. If any company has to close there, there's going to be a cascading effect on that regional development in that area, both in terms of jobs as well as secondary and tertiary jobs. So it's not only direct jobs. And this is going to be a major impact. So I think there's two options basically the cement industry's got. And that would be consequences to jobs. Basically, it's going to be our competitiveness. So one, they could close. Some of the companies would close to ensure competitiveness. Or, you know, they could consolidate. And the international trend is this consolidation. For example, in Europe, Lafarge and Holcim industries consolidated internationally. In South America, we had one or two companies sort of like Simpor and Intercement has consolidated. We might see that happen as well. All that has consequences to jobs. So one, we can pass through the costs and then the consumer is going to pay for the carbon tax, infrastructure costs are going to go up, or we can absorb it. But be that as it may, I think the question is, there's going to be loss of competitiveness. So if you look on the left curve, if we close some of the facilities, we're going to have regional economic development issues rising in the area, and Luxembourg is an example, as a result of job losses. If there's consolidation, there's still going to be job losses. There's going to be job losses in terms of production, because we'll have consolidation of different companies probably merging. We're also going to have an increasing amount of clinker and cement being imported in the country. We're going to have less mining because we don't have to mine the limestone because clinker comes in at very cheap cost. So we're once again going to have job losses in the mining sector. So in terms of importing clinker, etc., we're also going to have direct implications to the waste economy in terms of alternative fuels and resources. An example is Australia, where they are thinking of no longer producing cement. They're just going to import it, and the waste tires, the waste is all going into China as fuel. So I think there's a whole range of cascading effects that could take place. A year or two, three years ago, the PPC CEO, which is one of our listed companies in the country, Mr. Daryl Castle, indicated that he predicts consolidation taking place in this country as a result of competitiveness and price absorptivity capacity. This is an example of a listed company where you can see, if you look at the bottom rows, the cost for returns on investments in this country, we're looking at -1.4% versus 8% internationally. Work tax is going to be -3.3%. So this is what the figures show in the annual report. So it's a real problem in terms of returns on investment. The implications of that is, I think these are just some references I've put in to see you can look at international literature, which supports it's a capital-intensive industry, it's an energy-intensive industry. Our country is going through tremendous hikes in electricity pricing, so we're having that problem in this country. So what are the implications? If we pass through the carbon tax, there's going to as a result of our trade-exposed sector, we're going to have dumping of imported cement, and we're going to have competitors will be compromised. If we absorb the price, we're going to go mechanization route. There'll be probably staff rationalization and consolidation taking place. So these are real implications, and I think we need to ensure the consequences to the energy-intensive cement sector and trade-exposed sector. So I think this slide is basically indicating what I've just said in terms of the absorption capacity. It's emphasizing it. And then in terms of the timing of the tax, we believe the socioeconomic condition, the economic status of the country at the moment, we're quite down, so one has to reconsider if there's a need to impose the current tax as it is at the moment. We believe there's various issues still to be addressed, such as the GHG reporting guidelines that's still not been signed off. The information management system for GHG reporting is still not finalized. So, for example, this year it's going to be submitted manually, which is not good in terms of, I think, good tax practice. Carbon budgets, we still have major issues around how the allocation process is taking place. The relationship between the carbon budgets and carbon tax, we still don't have a clear understanding in terms of the alignment. The carbon offsets, once again, you know, there's a limit and threshold on the carbon offsets. I think there may be opportunities to relook at offsets if the purpose is to reduce GHG emissions rather than having thresholds. Monitoring and verification systems for carbon reporting, I think that still needs a lot of work to be done. So at this stage, we believe there's adequate policy interventions taking place in this country already, and there's proactive work taken by the cement sector and perhaps many other industrial sectors. So, you know, there is a possibility to reduce GHG emissions as we've demonstrated in the cement sector. Allowances, we still do not know or we do not have confirmation around our performance benchmarks nor the waste-related allowances. Well, there's been some decision around that. And then post-2022, what is very important is our company still believe there's a lot of uncertainty, and that is a challenge to their midterm budgeting processes. So there are major industry sustainability impacts. So in conclusion, we believe that the impact of the proposed carbon tax will have a serious impact, further diminishing returns of an industry in distress. It is likely to result in the inability to attract investors to fund continuous investments required if we're having so low rates of return of our investments, why should funders provide more funding for mitigation actions, for example? Then there's local economic development issues that's going to play around in terms of the cement hubs. So we believe that's going to have broader national socio-economic impacts. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir, for a very interesting presentation. Only time I work with cement is when I do something at home.
It's going to cost you more next year.
But there we get another view on it. Thank you very much for this. This is an eye-opener.
Thank you.
Honourable members, the next presenter will be Black First, Land First. Are they here? No. Then we go straight to Sasol. Is Sasol here? Sasol, are they? Sasol. You can come here and just connect your system. As we proceed, note your questions.
Okay, I will move
to the Airlines Association. In one of the slides, you mentioned alignment. The word alignment. Just elaborations on the agenda, you must just clarify alignment. The cement people, you are already doing something to minimize that. That table, that graph, that shows a decrease. You've got to clarify that. What did you do to get to that point? Right. You must always have a woman in your delegation. Learn a lesson. Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
15 minutes to you.
Thank you. Chair, my name is Johan Tayser. I lead the regulatory services team at Sasol. Next to me, I've got Henry Gilfillan, who's from our strategy team and who leads the strategy part. I've got Hema next to Henry that looks after that head of tax within Sasol as well. Chair, what we are going... Head of tax. Chair, what we are going to do is firstly... Let me just express my appreciation to this committee, allowing us firstly to make a written submission and to make this oral submission. We are going to be less on introducing Sasol because I'd like to think that some people know who we are, and we are going to go straight into what we believe are the issues with the carbon tax and with the Custom and Excise Act. And then I'm going to allow Henry and Hema to help me with specifically the technical concerns we have. I think, Chair, I must at this stage also express our appreciation to National Treasury because we've been involved in this process since 2009, since the very beginning. Yeah. And there has been some comments that has been included. However, the ones that we are highlighting today are the ones that are of key concern to us still. So I think it is very important that we don't paint the picture that National Treasury hasn't been listening. There has been a spirit of cooperation and collaboration, but as we say, there's still things that we cannot agree on, and hence we are here today. Chair, what I will do, I will quickly set the scene for the committee in terms of Sasol. And just on this particular slide, I think it's important that, as the heading says, we are committed to transitioning to a lower carbon economy. But more importantly, Sasol acknowledges the fact that we need to start transitioning to a lower carbon economy. I think what's important, because of the potential impact of doing so, that transition that happens to a lower carbon economy needs to be done in such a manner that it is not just orderly, but there's also policy certainty, and we also know exactly how that's going to take place. If this takes place in a manner where we don't have policy certainty, where we don't understand exactly how this is going to play out, we have just heard from our previous presenter the impact on jobs. At Sasol in South Africa alone, we employ 29,500 people, the bulk of that being in Mpumalanga and in the Free State. I think from a climate change perspective, when it comes to carbon pricing, Sasol participates in the voluntary carbon budget. More importantly, during the negotiations of the Paris Agreement, Sasol was one of the companies that wrote to the Minister of Environmental Affairs at the time, the late Edna Molewa, requesting her and urging her to please sign the Paris Agreement on behalf of South Africa, because we believe that's the right thing to do. I think transitioning to a lower carbon economy, Sasol introduced natural gas in 2004 in the Gauteng area, and in doing so, Chair, we were able to undertake projects that lowered emissions inside in our facilities by 12.5 million tons. We also enabled some of the customers that we substituted some of the more carbon-intensive feedstocks, and that resulted in just over 3 million tons per annum being saved. On our international negotiating position, we have been an active participant in most of the COPs since the Kyoto Protocol, and I think from a South Africa's industrialization effort, we believe that it's important that we look at carbon offset projects, and we've also been a participant in that. Chair, the scene that I'm trying to set is that we are not unwilling to transition. We are not unwilling to embrace the low carbon economy. But it's important that because of the position that South Africa finds itself in, the fact that we are pretty much really at the moment using coal as a feedstock, we need to ensure that as we transition to lower carbon feedstock, that takes place in a orderly manner where there's policy certainty for companies like ourselves. And I think I'm going to ask Henry and Hemmer to now speak to specifically some of the issues that we have, in particular with the climate change, with the carbon tax bill, and then also with the customer and excise bill.
Thank you, Chair. So I think I'd like to build on what my colleague Johannes just alluded to, and I also think we're also building on what our colleague from the cement industry has highlighted. Our concerns around alignment between the carbon tax and the carbon budget. I think we were at least we welcomed the presentation that National Treasury made to your colleagues in the Standing Committee on Finance in November and December, where they referred to the discussions between National Treasury and Department of Environmental Affairs around aligning the carbon budget and carbon tax. I'd just like to highlight, and again, alluding to what Johan has spoken about, that we have been engaged on this for a very long time, and we, as Sasol, have been raising this issue around misalignment since 2013. The concern, though, that we have, Chair, is that the bill before you does not reflect this alignment between the carbon budget and the carbon tax. It's in fact very much still misaligned with the carbon budget approach. And our concern really is that's twofold. One is it creates still the possibility and concern around us facing double taxation and misalignment between two instruments that are really trying to achieve the same thing. And secondly, it's still creating a lot of uncertainty as to what the regime will look like post-2022. And given that for us to either invest in further economic growth or in mitigation projects, if we were to implement something In 2022, we need to start planning today already. So providing that certainty is critical. So we really would request that the current bill we look at how we can improve the current bill to provide that certainty, either by compelling the minister to adjust the bill to reflect some of what National Treasury was proposing in November, December, or at the very least, to outline how that that process would be addressed. Moving on, Chair, I think we'd also like to highlight, and again, some of these issues have been raised before, but certain commitments have been made, particularly around a lot of the regulations and various workshops and discussions that were to be held to implement those, to outline those regulations and implement them. And some of them, those deadlines have already passed, some are we getting very close to, and we still don't, so as we sit today, we don't have line of sight of many of the regulations and exactly how large parts of this bill would be implemented, which once again makes life difficult for us. A very important issue, again, that has been highlighted is around electricity pricing. There was once again an undertaking around maintaining price neutrality, so in other words, the carbon tax would be implemented in a way that would not lead to higher electricity pricing, and we're still awaiting detail into exactly how that would be implemented. I think finally, we do have concerns around the implementation of the carbon tax using the Customs and Excise Act. Once again, there were certain commitments made around allowing for companies having a company-wide licensing, as well as marrying the disconnect between greenhouse gas reporting, which is done at a sectoral or a company level, and income tax or company tax, which is sometimes in the legal entity, and these two do not necessarily always match. So resolving some of these fairly practical issues are critical before we can actually see this bill implemented. So to expand on some of those, particularly the customs and excise issues, I'd like to hand over to my colleague Hema Woodley.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, everybody. I think I'd like to start off firstly by saying council is one of the largest taxpayers in South Africa, if not the largest taxpayer. We, in 2018, we had paid over 40 billion rand in taxes just towards the South African economy. So we take our compliance obligations very seriously. We want to make sure we do comply with our reporting requirements. But in order for us to do so, the challenges we have practically in terms of using the current design of the Customs and Excise Bill to be able to administer the carbon tax is posing a serious challenge for us. And to start off with, we can highlight the penalty regime, which is quite punitive in terms of the current bill. And there's limited, if not no, discretion in terms of how these penalties are administered. Now, bear in mind that the carbon tax liability is based on emissions, and the determination of emissions is not an exact science. So there's always, that does then, in fact, leave room for error or potential non-compliance. And based on that, I mean, there is no room at the moment for that kind of discretion. Now, the Tax Administration Act, which specifically excludes the customs and excise, unfortunately, and the current Customs Control Bill in its form, which replicates the penalty regime system that is followed by the Tax Administration Act, but bear in mind that Customs Control Act is not yet promulgated. Now, what that does, it actually gives you a different categories of the misdemeanor and applies different thresholds of penalties that can be applied based on the type of misdemeanor. But unfortunately, in the current bill, it doesn't give you that kind of relief in terms of to the extent there is any element of non-compliance. The second issue we have is around the fact that, I mean, the powers of your customs officials are quite wide, and understandably so, because it deals with a lot of illicit goods, banned substances, and carbon tax isn't a good per se. So, I mean, in terms of the powers it has where there is non-compliance to be able to shut down the facilities, for example, of a taxpayer, that causes a serious concern for us, because if there's unintentional non-compliance, like we said, it's a transitional issue and there is going to be possible challenges initially. So we that powers needs to be separated between the types of offences where it is intentional criminal activities versus a typical taxpayer who's trying to comply with the legislation. And the third aspect that we have an issue with was regards to the lack of alignment with regards to your reporting to different organs of state. Currently, the Department of Environmental Affairs requires reporting on a group level, whereas the current Customs and Excise Bill requires it at an entity level. Now, bear in mind, if we take one of our facilities, for example, our Sinfield facilities in Secunda, it produces alcohol, so we registered that facility for excise purposes. It also generates power. That facility is then also registered for electricity levies. Now we have to register the same facility again for carbon tax purposes. Now, you can imagine the challenges you have from an administrative point of view to be able to do so. And over and above that, we need some kind of alignment or consistency in terms of how we report these numbers to the different organs of state, which is actually quite lacking in the current legislation or the draft bill.
Just repeat that sentence. That is lacking. What is lacking?
The alignment, the lack of alignment in terms of how we report. Okay. And then the other challenge that we have is that when there was a commitment made, the National Treasury, that when the carbon tax will replace your electricity levies. Now, with the introduction of carbon taxes, there has been no clarity in terms of what would happen to the electricity levies, and there was also a commitment there would not be double taxation. But in this instance, we'll be paying electricity levy and a potential carbon tax, and that would actually result in a double taxation for the company. And then also then the carbon tax design results in a significant increase for Sasol in terms of your mining industry in particular. So currently Sasol Mining pays a royalty tax, which is based on the 2.5% per ton mined, and that royalty tax is at least 75% of your corporate tax. So assuming that we pay 100 million of corporate tax, we then pay 75 million in this example of royalty tax. Now, over and above that now, with the introduction of the carbon tax is also based on a per ton mine. So again, you're going to have additional carbon taxes, which, I mean, the mining industry is already struggling, and it is our biggest employer currently in the group in terms of the number of employees. Now, any additional taxes obviously places a significant burden then on the mining industry additionally. So the proposal from us at this stage is to say that we need to postpone the promulgation of the carbon tax to align with the Customs Control Act, the Customs Duty Act, and the Customs and Excise Amendment Act. These acts have been redesigned purposefully to be able to address the fact that the old existing Customs and Excise Act is not very much aligned to what the business operating models are. There's inconsistencies. So that's why we want this carbon tax bill to be postponed to the promulgation of the new Customs Control Act, Duty Act, and the Amendment Act. And also in terms of the payment mechanism, what we propose is there's some kind of payment mechanism that's similar to the way it's done for your corporate income tax currently, or for your provisional tax payments, for your personal income tax as well. So it works on the 80-20 principle. So to the extent that you have your liability, you have a year within which to determine your liability, and then to the extent there is subsequently you've identified that there is additional liability, you still have the opportunity to do a top-up without any additional adverse penalty consequences for the taxpayer. So that is our proposal currently, and then obviously to be able to consult further on the public in terms of how we mitigate the double taxation in the mining industry and insofar as the electricity levies are concerned.
3 minutes.
Thank you.
Chair, just to close off then, so what we are requesting is that there be serious consideration around our proposals around creating further certainty or greater certainty within the bill around alignment, as well as addressing some of the issues that have just been raised by my colleague, and actually postponing the promulgation of the carbon tax until such time as we can see the promulgation of the Customs Control Act. And then finally, to just highlight the insisting on rules or regulations that would allow for the deduction of the electricity levy from the carbon tax to avoid carbon double taxation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you to Sasol Treasury, slide 3, 4, 5, and 6. You will have prepared yourself because you are on the agenda. It's at 4 o'clock, responses by the Treasury to give some guidance there. Black First, Land First Movement. Welcome, sir. Are you using...
No, I'll speak directly from the...
Just before you start, honorable members, the gentleman will speak from this document. Yabo.
But...
And you've got 15 minutes to take us through your presentation.
Thanks, Chair.
Pleasure. Welcome, yeah.
Good morning to the committee as well, and thank you very much to the Secretary, who has been of great assistance. My name is Lindsay Maslop. I'm the national spokesperson for Black First, Land First. We are a black consciousness revolutionary movement inspired by Steve Bantu Biko and Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe. We also take on a Sankarist approach, and I have the pleasure of informing you, I think this will be one of our last committee meetings where we will be attending as ordinary citizens of this country. After 8 May, we will be here as ministers to ensure that we hold accountable all those who are supposed to serve the people of this country.
You go straight to your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair. The strategic objective of BLF is the complete destruction of white supremacy and the installation of a system that responds to the total needs of the people. To this end, BLF recognizes that the main contradiction is white supremacy, which needs black solidarity for it to be destroyed. BLF regards energy sovereignty as critical to the liberation of black people, and locates the current framing of South Africa's energy sector as anti-black, anti-poor, and unable to play any significant role in industrialization and thus provide quality jobs for the oppressed. Currently, the energy sector is unable to provide enough energy to meet the basic needs, let alone surplus, to ensure industrialization and the creation of quality jobs. This is due to the political influence from pro-white monopoly capital agents. They are pro-Washington, pro-London, pro-Brussels agents who seek to privatize the sector at the expense of the poor black oppressed. Thus, this proposed carbon tax bill continues in this line, failing to address either energy sovereignty, the need to industrialize in order to create jobs, and places the burden of combating climate change on the oppressed. The carbon tax bill is in line with the Paris Agreement. The agreement itself burdens the developing nations with responding to the problem of climate change, while the West refuses to take responsibility for their role in continually destroying the planet through the looting of minerals without care for the oppressed and the colonized. The latter can be seen in the message from decision from Donald Trump to withdraw the United States of America from the Paris Agreement. And he says, "It is an agreement that disadvantages the United States. The West wishes to continue its looting and decimation of the planet with impunity, while ensuring the burden yet again falls on the oppressed." As for this reason, it's very ironic that this bill comes at a time in South Africa when our emissions targets we're on track to meet them by 2025, the 42% reduction, while the United States of America has no interest in just being part of the Paris Agreement. The carbon tax bill is thus just an attempt by the South African government to further appease the West, while ensuring that white monopoly capital corporations, particularly in energy and mining, do not carry the burden of fighting climate change. In its current form, the carbon tax bill will hit the consumer hardest, as well as the small and medium-sized businesses, directly destroying any possibility of sustainable quality job creation. The impact will be felt by the poor, and mainly black people as well as black businesses. The Carbon Majors report in 2017 revealed that since 1988, only 100 companies, majority white-owned, produce more than 70% of the greenhouse gases in the globe today. Of those 100 companies, you will see the following names, and you will recognize them. Total SA at number 19. BHP Billiton Limited at number 20. Anglo American at number 31. Glencore at 43. Exxaro Resources at 69. In its current form, the carbon tax bill thus seeks to hold the poor black oppressed liable for the crimes of 100 companies. Essentially, it is the poor who suffer from a destroyed planet. And it is the poor who must now financially foot the bill of the decimation of the planet by the 100 companies, amongst which some are owned by the Ruperts, in the case of Total South Africa, and the Oppenheimers, in the case of Anglo America, and Glazenberg, in the case of Glencore. Not only are these white monopoly capital companies not being punished for the decimation of the planet, but the carbon tax bill will see tax rebates for these very white monopoly capital corporations, which simply need to attempt to phase in emissions targets in order to benefit. The likes of Glencore and Exxaro Resources, who are not only among the top 100 planet destroyers, but have played a key role in destroying South Africa's energy utility, Eskom. Yet they now will even further benefit from trade exposure allowance and the performance allowance, amongst others. The proposed carbon tax bill will also benefit IPPs. The likes of NL Green Power, Mainstream Renewable Power, Sun Power, where Johan Rupert is a shareholder through Total SA, as well as Pembani Energy and Shanduka Group, where Putuma Nkleko is the owner, Patrice Motsepe is a rep, and others will benefit from not only selling electricity at three times the cost, but also from the tax rebates due to the attempt to go green with the green economy. This is legalized looting at the expense of the poor. Johan Rupert is the owner of Total SA. He has just been given exploration rights for oil, along with Putuma, who is a 20% shareholder in Engen. They are also he's also rated at number 19 in terms of most greenhouse gases produced since the 80s in the world. Yet he's going to benefit through IPPs, the green economy, via Sun Power. This is a typical case of accumulation by crisis. White monopoly capital, in this case Total SA, and its owner Johan Rupert, goes around drilling and damaging the planet, and then tells us we have a crisis, only to present the green economy or the REIPPs as a solution, where he owns the companies that implement the solution, and who pays for that? It's the same victims of exploration. By exploration, I mean colonization, and it is the poor black oppressed. This carbon tax bill is thus by no means an attempt to fight climate change, but simply seeks to satisfy the Paris Agreement while justifying $1.4 trillion worth of IPPs under the illusion of the green economy. The World Health Organization in 2008 completed a study that showed that although 80% of South African households are electrified, paraffin remains the primary fuel for cooking, cleaning, and heating, and the study went on to show that 90% of people surveyed use paraffin daily. In 2013, the very Department of Energy reported that candles, firewood, and paraffin are present in more than 70% of low-income households. A 2016 Stats SA report revealed that 3 million households are using paraffin stoves. These are conservative stats. This carbon tax bill will drive poverty, ensuring the 3 million plus households who are already subject to paraffin stoves must now pay an extra tax to enrich Johan Rupert, and cover for the crimes of white monopoly capital companies like Total SA, Exxaro Resources, and Glencore Limited. In 2016, Germany, which is the leader in renewable energy, spent 25 billion euros alone. Of that, their consumers carried the 23 billion euros. It's now close to 20 years since Germany decided to go green, spending trillions of euros, yet they are failing to meet their goal of only 40% carbon emissions set for 2020. France, on the other hand, went nuclear, which resulted in more than 75% of their household electricity being generated by nuclear, and France is a global leader in fighting climate change. Sadly, though, this is the case with all European successes. It was done by very Africa suffering. Niger possesses 7% of the world's uranium, It is the major supplier to France, and despite more than 50% of households in Niger being without electricity, France benefits from nuclear energy, both in cost of electricity, as well as the limitation on the environmental impact. Namibia, South Africa, and Niger are all among the top 10 for uranium reserves. Africa enjoys not less than one-fifth of the world uranium. Yet, a World Energy Outlook report published in 2016 revealed that only 45% of African households have access to electricity. The reality is that nuclear energy is the cheapest and the cleanest source. Fifth generation nuclear technology sees only one-fifth of nuclear waste remaining, the rest being reused. Nuclear can bring energy sovereignty and ensure enough energy to ensure industrial growth and job creation. By this government's own admission, nuclear would have cost 400 billion less than the IPPs, and it would produce three times the amount of energy. And most importantly, nuclear energy is the cleanest source, cleaner than wind, cleaner than solar, cleaner than gas, cleaner than coal, cleaner than any other source of energy. A nuclear plant can be financed over a 20-year period. It can last 80 years and fully owned by the people of this country. The fact is that the proposed carbon tax body is the poor footing climate change cost of white monopoly capital companies and economic cost of the green economy. If the South African government is serious about combating climate change and ensuring energy sovereignty, industrialization, and creating quality jobs, then it must do the following. Scrap the carbon tax bill, as the cost will be carried directly by the poor. Products such as petrol, oil, paraffin will be subject to the tax, and they together will have lock-on food costs and goods costs, which will impact the poor directly. Scrap IPPs. There is nothing, the IPPs do not constitute green energy, nuclear does. It's at a cost of 1.4 trillion and is too costly. They produce a third of the energy on a good day when the sun is hopefully shining. Today it's a bad day. We're not producing solar energy compared to nuclear. And this is the only way that we can solve the climate change crisis. Urgently, increase nuclear energy generation, considering for a minimum of 30% of energy needs, South Africa's energy needs within the next 10 years. This will be the cheapest way to ensure energy sovereignty, and because it is the cleanest energy source, it will be the most meaningful method in fighting climate change. Pursuit of new coal must also be adopted. Together with nuclear and gas, it should ensure enough energy, 100% of the energy needs in our country. We are not saying there's no place for renewable energy, but the place for renewable energy is with an alternative renewable energy model, which directly benefits the poor as well as black emerging business. To this end, all new homes, black-owned farms, and industrial projects should be assisted with renewable energy generation, and they must be incentivized where they produce more energy than what they need. So you don't place renewable energy within white monopoly capital companies that loot and with impunity. You place it in the hands of the people so that the person whose RDP or better house you built can generate solar energy, or a black-owned farm can generate wind energy, use it on that place of industrial or home usage, and the surplus goes back into the grid and the people benefit. Redistribution of stolen land in the hands of the 35,000 white families to black people, thus creating 1 million new farmers. This, together with the implementation of the alternative renewable energy model, alone could see the 42% reduction in emissions target met within 5 years. Nationalization of the mining sector. I was surprised that the person who spoke before us on behalf of Cecil said that they want less punishment to these white multinational companies within the mining sector. They stole our mines, they own our mines, the likes of Glencore, Exxaro. We must nationalize the mining sector so that we can offset the cost of nuclear energy generation, as well as balance out the emissions production through mining, and together ensure the possibility of industrialization and quality job creation. The support proposal places the burden of combating climate change with the wealthy and ensures the possibility of a sustainable long-term plan to ensure energy sovereignty, industrialization, protection and development of black new and small business, and therefore quality job creation. finally, BLF warns that should the carbon tax bill be passed, the levels of inequality in this country will grow, and the poor landless black majority will foot the bill. I just want to tell you one thing that happened around paraffin. Before the 2014 elections, a tender was given to Caltex in the Northwest, and they distributed 58 million rands of paraffin to homes. Why did they do it? It was at the behest of the ANC government in that province. They did that to get votes. We are facing another election now, and people have come to this parliament to pass a bill to oppress the very people you want to go and ask for votes. You can't pass a carbon tax bill that enriches Johan Rupert and the likes for IPPs and the illusion of green economy while you're putting the burden on 3 million households to cover for the extra paraffin costs that will come from this carbon tax. If you love black people and the people of this country, don't pass this bill, nationalize the mines, reject the IPPs, introduce nuclear energy, and stand with black people so that we can ensure a new world, a new economy, and a black first society. Thank you.
Let your voice be heard, honorable members. Thank you for your presentation. I see there's some of your colleagues that also arrived here. Welcome. Honorable members, we have now received 4 presentations. We're going into this section. I call it session 1, the deliberations on the presentations that was presented. And please be to the point that we start our next session with presentations at 10 to 12. Questions? Honorable Isaac, number 1. Honorable Monakedi, number 2. Honorable Isaac, you may put your question. The presenters must now listen carefully because you'll get the opportunity to reply.
Chairperson, yes, thank you for the opportunity. Good morning, everybody. It is thus far been very interesting, and I received some of the presentations yesterday, and I tried to peruse them, but I must be honest, it was quite a bit of reading, so obviously somewhat difficult to digest everything at one time. But nevertheless, it is very clear from the presentations that we've thus far had as to the feelings and the thoughts regarding this carbon tax bill and its tax and tax upon tax. And last week in the public hearings, we had some quality constructive input from the likes of COSATU, etc., which also was very thought-provoking. Now, I just specifically want to allude, not get into detail in every presentation so I can give some others a chance, but specifically to the presentation by Cecil. And the interesting comments that come regarding Cecil's contribution to the fiscus, etc. And particularly of interest to me was your strong call for the alignment of all these various taxes that we currently have. And I didn't hear a detail, or I couldn't grasp in detail the understanding where you're calling for an alignment of the various taxes. And I just need to understand that when we get a chance for you to answer, how do you propose the alignment then of all these different taxes like customs and excise that you've alluded to, etc.? And then what is the proposal? It's easy to say we suggest these taxes to be ring-fenced. What is the proposal in terms to National Treasury in terms of how then must we ring-fence all these funds? I just wanted to get some clarity on that. Chairperson, yeah, thank you.
For the second half of 2019, the Treasury and SARS will come with the tax laws, amendment bills, etc. That same question must be carried to that meeting when it's tabled and presented to us in the committee of Standing Committee Finance, select committee for finance. So if you come back, make that note in your diary that you put it. Honorable Monakeri.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thanks to the presentations I've made. I think they were very powerful, very clear. I want to check from the Association of Cement Manufacturing, what is that? Yes, ACMP. I just want to check from them because they alluded to the issue of timing with regard to the introduction of this bill. Does it mean, in principle, they are not opposed to it? The only issue that they have is the timing. And also, the same question goes to Sasol. The issue they are raising here is the alignment. Does it mean that if that particular challenge of alignment is addressed, then we can accordingly go ahead and make sure that an appropriate carbon tax is then enacted? I just want to check those. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Nakedi. Any other member? Honorable Nzimande is from the province KZN where the sun actually rises.
Thank you, Chair. Isaac, don't contest. All right. Now, just one quick one. The cementers, towards the end of the slides, they make a statement that I think, Chair, must be a little bit elaborated. That they say that the uncertainty will affect the midterm budget. But you know, in what way, Chair, that if they could provide that clarity on the statement that they've made to us, their concluding slides. With Blackfest, they say, Chair, the bill must be scrapped. The elaboration on the flip side, Chair, it means that they are agreeing with what they are calling the white monopoly capital, because they are here to oppose the bill, in essence. So both of them are together. Is that a correct understanding? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Samandi. My question to the Airline Association, you also referred to alignment. That one slide, I think, was at the top. If you can just clarify that for us. To our presenters, I'm going to give you each 4 minutes to reply. I'm very lenient today. Let's start with the airlines. Oh. Yeah, flying high.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman. Thank you, Chair. The only area where we refer to the alignment issue is that, as we mentioned in our presentation, we are opposed to the implementation of the carbon tax for domestic aviation. We also put forward the CORSIA, which is the Carbon Offsetting Reduction Scheme for International Aviation, as the scheme that has been agreed to by 192 states in ICAO for to introduce carbon offsetting for international airlines, and that's going to be introduced in a phased approach from 2021 onwards. In fact, from this year, as my colleague mentioned, from 1 January 2019, we are collecting all the data on emissions for every international flight that is flying so that we can create a database on which we can measure and ensure that the carbon offsetting is actually done. So the alignment we're talking about is if we do not do carbon taxes in South Africa, we're saying implement and apply the same agreement of CORSIA effectively to domestic aviation, so that we can have when South Africa effectively if it decides to obviously volunteer for CORSIA, then that's a stage when that could be done in the near term, but that any system that is actually, any scheme that is implemented for international aviation can be applied to domestic aviation, so that we don't have dual administrative burdens so that you have the same airline, for example, the South African Airways that operates domestic flights as well as international flights, will have to actually manage two different systems according to the carbon tax system and according to the Corsair system. So that's what we are meaning by alignment, that we have domestic and international aviation using exactly the same scheme, and we submit that that should be according to the Corsair International scheme. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Association of Cementiers. There you are, sir.
Thank you.
Let's check that your mic is working.
Yeah, it's working. Thanks. Okay, I've had two questions. On the first one, in terms of the timing of the bill, I think our concern with the carbon tax bill is just not the timing, but also the content and details of the bill. We believe, as I've demonstrated in my slide, where we have certainly demonstrated and confirmed reduction in GHG emissions over a long period of time, that there are sufficient policies in place to reduce GHG emissions. And the question is, the carbon tax bill as a policy instrument is certainly one that we should be considering, but is it the appropriate one at this stage in time if we can demonstrate reductions in the absence of carbon tax? So that's the timing we're talking about. It's just not the against the timing at this point in time, but it's one of the suite of instruments, and is it appropriate to do that? I think in terms of timing, just to further clarify, it's our readiness. There's a whole range of alignment issues, the performance benchmarks, etc., that hasn't been finalized yet. The NEAS system at the Department of Environment Affairs to capture the data is still not in place. And then obviously the socioeconomic impact at the moment in terms of where we are in terms of our national development plans, etc., to provide more equity to all the populations. So I think that's the question around the timing issue. It's beyond the timing, yes or no, now or later. I think there's a whole range of issues that need to be talked about. We're certainly going to have job losses in our cement-producing hubs. There's no doubt about that. We're seeing that trend internationally in terms of either increasing the price or actually having mergers between industries. So that's the first one. The second one was around the challenge to our companies. What they're saying is up to 2022 for the first phase, we certainly know what the carbon price is, the nature of allowances, etc. But being capital-intensive, energy-intensive industries, we need medium to long-term budget projections in terms of how the industry should grow or not grow. And for that, they need projections. And there's still not full clarity around the carbon pricing beyond from 2022 onwards, and whether the allowances are going to stay or not, etc. So how do we project, or how do the companies project in terms of their commitments to the carbon tax, in addition to all the emerging environmental management programs that are emanating in the country? Thanks.
A follow-up, Chair. So are they saying then that the bill is not adequate in dealing with that, or they prefer a situation that matter is clarified either through regulations or some other means? Thank you, Chair.
You heard that?
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Chair. I think, this requires quite a bit of discussion, but I think the way I would respond, or our members would respond if they were here, was that they certainly require business certainty in terms of how the cement sector would be operating in this country, in terms of the regulatory obligations, as well as the challenges with cheap imports from the East, because it is a trade sector, trade-exposed sector, and there are currently discussions taking place at ITEC around these issues. But this is a challenge all over the world because it's a very low profitable, bulky product. Thanks.
Thank you. Land first.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Member, for the question. Let me first say that it's like saying that the ANC and the EFF want land expropriation, but it's more than a year afterwards. It's simply not true that White Monopoly Capital rejects this bill. As I've explained, Johan Rupert, if you take a case study of Johan Rupert, he owns 40% of Total SA. The oil companies create the crisis. He also owns SunPower. SunPower directly benefits from REIPPs. You create a brouhaha by, as Rupert and White Monopoly Capital has done, and you provide a false solution, renewable energy. You tax the poor because you're presenting a false solution and they benefit. So it is completely false that white monopoly capital rejects taxation of the poor. In fact, they benefit from it. They benefit directly. You are placing the burden on 3 million households. You are not taxing mining companies. You are not punishing Total. In fact, you are rewarding Total SA. And at the same time, he takes from the oil sector, he takes from the renewable sector. So thank you for acknowledging white monopoly capital exists. And it is a fact they are benefiting from both oil and renewable energy. And BLF rejects this bill on that basis that you can't have a situation where Rupert steals from the poor at the level of the oil sector, which you've given on a freely to him now. At the same time, you tax the poor and make us pay to his son power for the problem that he's created. So let's fight white monopoly capital together and not play games with the poor that use paraffin on a daily basis at their expense. Thank you.
Thank you, Cecil.
The bill is dealing with...
Oh, sorry, I didn't...
Yeah, sorry, Chair. The bill is dealing with emissions to cap that. And now you are saying that the bill is taxing the poor. So something is missing me, Chair. Perhaps if we could put it in more simpler terms, I guess, it's a bit complicated for me, but this is what the bill is trying to do, to regulate tax, to cap. There's
giving you 2 minutes.
And now he says that it's taxing the poor, 3 million is quoting. So if you could just clarify in simpler terms to help us, because we're sitting with a bill, we have to make choices.
Yeah. Look, there's no taxation of mining companies here. It's as simple as that. They are incentivized for simply attempting to participate in emissions reduction. There's no taxation of mining white monopoly capital. They are your bill states, your bill speaks to performance rewards for these companies. So there's no taxation of mining companies. Let us not lie to ourselves. But there is a taxation of the poor for usage of paraffin, for these basic things that our people use on a daily basis. That is a fact. So this illusion in your mind that says... The illusion that says white monopoly capital mining is going to be taxed and they're going to lose out is completely nonsensical. They are going to be rewarded, but not only in the mining sector, but also in the renewable energy sector, as I've displayed with SunPower. So, no, there's no cost for emissions reduction or for non-compliance by mining companies. In fact, you even give them a 5 to 8 year allowance period for this. So, no, the poor is going to be affected by this on a daily basis, indirectly and directly.
Are there any other follow-up questions? Then we go to Cecil. Before Cecil replies to Treasury, if it's possible, when you reply this afternoon, a point is being made. The mines are not paying tax. Can you give that a picture to us, what is actually happening? And Dr. Makalima, that you do a benchmarking internationally, which you can give to us next Tuesday, maybe Monday, Tuesday, on this whole issue of carbon tax globally. Where is it done? What is the outcome? Blah, blah, blah. Some homework for you, Sasha.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, maybe just a few clarifications. The first one is that there was a question directed at us for, number one, looking at ring fencing. We did not mention ring fencing in our presentation. I believe the Airline Association, in fact, referred to that, so I would respectfully just push that question back to them. There was also a couple of questions relating to alignment. You'll recall in our presentation that we spoke to 2 sets of alignments that need to take place. The first one referring to carbon tax and the carbon budget. And I'm going to ask Henry Gofillen to just elaborate on that specifically. And then there was also the other alignment we referred to with respect to the Customs and Excise Act in terms of the carbon tax. And Hema will speak to that. I just want to ask members that if they do have the SASL written submissions, on page 3, there's in fact a proposal that we've made with regard specifically to carbon tax and carbon budget alignment, which may assist in also answering the question, and that will help Henry also in giving further detail on that specifically.
Thank you, sir. Honourable Member, the question specifically around alignment between the carbon budget and carbon tax. So the Department of Environmental Affairs are in the process of implementing a system of carbon budgeting. And traditionally how that would work is you would be allocated a certain volume of emissions and you would then pay tax on the emissions should you exceed your budget, and those taxes or penalties could be quite punitive. So that is the essence of the proposal that we've made in our written submission as to how we believe such alignment can be achieved, and we believe that is possible to do even within the framework of what we're currently looking at. However, I do want to stress that the current bill does not in any way achieve that alignment, and therefore, in its current form, we do not support it. However, you know, given that we have put forward a suggestion as to how that alignment was to occur, should that suggestion be taken up, obviously we would support it. I think we also have been consistent, and we said so in our presentation, that we do support the implementation of a carbon price. We see that as a necessary instrument. I'll now hand over to my colleague to talk about the customs and excise issues.
Thank you very much. Okay, the question is around the Customs Control Act and the alignment. Currently, the Customs Control Act non-compliance framework aligns that to the Tax Administration Act, which actually provides relief to taxpayers during the transitional and implementation phase of the carbon tax legislation. But the challenge is that the Customs Control Act has not yet been promulgated, and the current Customs and Excise Bill in its current form doesn't address the issue around how you deal with the penalty regimes. So that was one issue with regards to the request for the alignment thereof. And in terms of the tax on tax, currently the electricity levies is being paid by SASL, for example, and then we have now the carbon tax as well. So there has to be some kind of relief to make sure there's no double taxation on the same base that's been utilized in terms of determination of your electricity levies as well as your carbon tax. And then likewise with the royalty tax, it is determined based on a per ton basis, per ton mined, that is paid by the mining company. And over and above that, now there's the carbon tax is also based on a per ton mined, resulting in the double taxation of the same ton that's been mined, and hence the reason for the clarification around that. Thank you.
You done? Yes, Oliver Issa.
Thank you. I kind of grasp what you were implying, and yes, okay, maybe the aviation industry will pick up on the other one. But ironically, Chairperson, just based on what was said and in the replies that came out from the various stakeholders, I think it wouldn't be fair, and I think we need to place on record that it just is not right, and with absolute due respect, to make a statement and then for the chairperson to say to Treasury they must reply or respond on the fact that the mining industry is not paying tax. I mean, I think that's somewhat distasteful, and it's not right, because if you go through SASL's submission, which I've had a look at also, it says very, very clearly that this actually would, if approved, would be a form of a double taxation on the mining industry. So I think we should just clarify and clear the air that, you know, it's not very tasteful to say the mining industry doesn't pay tax. Then lastly, I just want to point out, Chairperson, hopefully somebody will pick up on it this afternoon, but you know, ESCOM, in my opinion, and I said this last week in the committee, you would recall, Chairperson, coming from Olanga myself, ESCOM, in my personal opinion, is one of the biggest, or in fact the biggest emitters carbon exposure that we go through nationally. And if I'm correct, Eskom right now is in a state where you and I both know, and I think the rest of South Africa knows, that they're in no position financially, absolutely zilch position, to go and still be liable for an additional tax. So, quite frankly, you know, what's coming out of the meeting and what's in terms of the submission.
Right. Eskom is not here to reply. I
respect
point
that.
You are making.
But
wish I were here that I could answer, but I can't.
Sure, I respect that. But we need to put it on record because we're talking about carbon tax.
Yeah, go to your point you want to make.
So the point I am making is that the alignment issue I understand very clearly, but we must be respectful of the fact that we cannot accept a blatant statement that the mining companies are not paying tax. I just wanted to put that on record. Thank you.
I refer honourable members to the documents that were tabled by the Minister of Finance on the 20th of February. The one document is called the Budget Review, and there's a whole chapter on tax. And to assist the Treasury, it's part of our homework as members to go back to that chapter and see what is captured there in terms of who's paying what. It is there. I'm just making this point. Any other follow-up?
Chair? Sorry, Chair. I believe the member has spoken to something that I said, and I have a right to respond to that, if you'd please allow me. Just one quick point. I was referring to point 13 on the submission and basically spoke to two areas. It speaks to the trade exposure allowance and the performance allowance. In that context, this current bill, mining companies get allowance for just showing some kind of impetus to trying to, you know, fix the impacts on emissions. They don't have to fulfill their duty. They must show a kind of willingness. I'm saying this bill, in its current form, does not tax mining companies for failure. It does not tax them for what they've done, for their punishment of the climate, or for their of emissions. But in fact, it rewards them. This is the context. So firstly, I don't think there's any apology needed or a reprimand from the member, but it's important to understand the context of what I'm speaking to. And then we then can link that to how Rupert takes from the right at the oil and gets blessings, and he takes on the left as well. That's the context. Thank you.
If you've got figures to support what you are saying, you can submit that to Solani.
Thank you.
Honourable members, thank you. We've come to the end of this round. We're going to allow the WWF, it's a world environmental organization, to come and present their paper. It's only two pages. We are a bit ahead of time, so we're going to allow them to do their submission, their presentation. WWF. Yes. No, we're not going that way. Look at that beer.
Just look there.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. We did submit our submission a day before the deadline and had asked for a slot on the agenda, so thank you. So our submission is in your packs. What am I doing here now? This one. And this is a sort of technical submission with facts and figures and numbers that you can refer to, but I'm going to speak a bit more broadly about the tax. So I want to speak about transition risk to the economy and socioeconomic dimensions. Firstly, competitiveness has arisen several times in the room. And we really have to start thinking about the global picture that is emerging in trade and in the way companies are responding. And in fact, it is becoming increasingly uncompetitive for an economy to be as carbon intensive as ours is. I mean, most of our electricity comes from coal. We still have to extend energy access for all, which includes being affordable, not just being on the grid. And we're starting to see trade barriers going up around the world against products that come from carbon-intensive economies or production processes. So, for example, the EU, which is one of our biggest trade partners, has said that it will no longer sign trade deals with a country which is not ratifying the Paris Agreement. So that's a signal. We are protected in that case because we have ratified, but it's a signal of the kind of trade barriers that are going to go up. We're going to see if countries are trying to meet their own Paris Agreement commitments, they will be protecting their domestic industries by putting in border tax adjustments for a high carbon product to be imported. Then another example would be that India receives about, 45% of our coal exports go to India. And India has set for itself an ambitious target to get out of coal-fired electricity, and they themselves have domestic coal reserves which they mine. So increasingly, as they shrink their use of coal, they're obviously going to first use their own domestic coal and import less and less from us. So those are the kinds of, dynamics I'm referring to in terms of competitiveness. So it's very important that we start preparing our economy for such a global world that is emerging. And to be looking backwards into the future doesn't help us. We are sitting with coal mines and coal-fired power plants, with Sasol, coal-to-liquid plants, and other high-emitting businesses, which are at risk of becoming stranded assets. One of the things that's happening is global mining companies, under the cover of black economic empowerment and other reasons, are selling off to South Africans because they know that very soon those coal mines will face challenges and no longer yield the return for investment. So basically they are selling us their stranded assets. And we really must be alert to this and prepare our economy. Then again, on the other side of the climate impacts, one sees the economic impacts of climate change on sectors like, and honorable members can think about your own province, and what the impacts would be in your province. So sectors like agriculture. In the Western Cape, we export fruit. And fruit is very water intensive, and yet the Western Cape is set to become ever drier. So we've got to start changing the kinds of products we grow, let alone for our own food security in the country, but also what we want to export. So agriculture is impacted, tourism heavily impacted. Chemicals industries can be highly impacted when the temperatures are so high that the chemical reactions required do not function at those temperature levels. And I'm not a technical person, but I think there are probably chemical engineers who could tell us more about that. Fisheries. So these are all examples of economic sectors which will be impacted by climate change, adding another reason why we have to start climate-proofing our economy. And infrastructure also is, must become climate smart, which speaks to my colleague from the Cementitious Association. So in fact, I think that Treasury has been very far-sighted in bringing this bill. It has been in process since 2009, the idea was first floated, and all of us, ourselves included, have been all along that journey with Treasury and have had ample opportunity to raise the issues, and Treasury, as Sasol said, has been very good in attending to the issues. So I really think, high emitters in this room, which don't represent the whole of business, they represent the high emitters, obviously would seek to delay and delay and delay the bill, but they've achieved that since 2009. So one of the things we do ask the committee is to please not delay it anymore. And, to the minister announced that it would be implemented from this year, and please to we request that the committee seriously consider that it should really be implemented now. Everybody's had that opportunity already. Okay, and I must say that Black First, Land First, in speaking about the kinds of allowances that the carbon tax bill allows, the exemptions from the tax, that a company can claim up to 95% exemption. So in that sense, it is correct to say that certain companies who qualify for different kinds of exemptions in there would hardly be taxed. And in our submission on the last page, we did the work of going to look at companies listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and then companies report to something called the Carbon Disclosure Project. That's a voluntary reporting platform. They report their emissions. And we actually looked at, used the carbon tax bill to look at what, how much tax would these companies be paying. They're the top 20 listed companies, top 20 emitters that are listed on the JSE. And I think councillors can see for yourselves, you know, what you think the impact is there. The numbers are there in absolute rand values and in percentage of revenue. Just to highlight that when we did this calculation, we used companies both scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, so more emissions than the bill actually covers. So the picture on here is a worst case scenario for companies. The actual situation is much lighter. Okay, and you know, people must be careful not to be economical with the truth. There's another, the carbon offset system is allowed for by Treasury. They're busy developing such a system. And in the carbon tax bill, you can claim up to 10% of your emissions by carbon offsetting them. Carbon offsets, remember, do not reduce emissions. They allow you to emit and try to save the same amount or a part of the same amount that you've emitted by investing somewhere else so that somebody else can reduce. It doesn't reduce emissions overall. So it's not an instrument to reduce emissions. It's an instrument to cope with the fact that you cannot reduce your own emissions more. And so you pay for somebody else to do it. In terms of ring fencing, I think Treasury will answer later today all the ways in which they have put revenue recycling into play. So some of the money will be going to help facilitate a lower carbon economy. And then this magic word, alignment. Wonderful. You can just say alignment and suddenly there's a major problem and everything has to stop. So I'll also say alignment. I don't think there's a problem between alignment between the carbon tax bill and the coming carbon budgets from the Department of Environmental Affairs. The tax bill does not incorporate anything about carbon budgets because it can't incorporate something which is not legal yet. So there is no alignment problem as we sit down. And Treasury and DEA, and very consultatively with all of us, are looking at how the budgets will be designed and how that will interact with the tax. We, as WWF, took a legal opinion because there isn't necessarily a need to align these instruments. They're different kinds of instruments. The one is an economy-wide instrument, that's the tax, to try and reorientate the whole economy. So as much as the heavy emitters who will be the most impacted by the tax are sitting in this room, all the businesses for whom actually a reorientation to a low-carbon economy is an opportunity don't come here. Because why would you come and raise your voice if in fact it's not a problem to you and indeed will be an opportunity to you. So the tax is that kind of instrument, you know, incentivize the low carbon, whereas the budgets are an accepted tool all around the world, you know, cap on emissions allowances, cap on a company's emissions. And the one is like the road levy, the tax. You know, you are taxed through the road levy, and you must pay that, and therefore you get infrastructure and so on. And the other one is an emissions cap, more like a speed limit. So these two things can operate in parallel, and they don't necessarily have to be so-called aligned. Treasury and the Department of Environmental Affairs are talking about how they will interact, which is a different thing. I mean, they don't even need to interact, quite frankly. So, and then in terms of alignment, we have a paper here. Unfortunately, I only have 5 copies, but anyone who's interested, which talks about the fiscus gives subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. And they're quite hidden and invisible, and the data's hard to get, so, you know, the numbers cover a very broad range. But we direct subsidies to the liquid fuel sector alone, and I'm talking about an economic sector now, not an emissions accounting sector. Thank you. We are giving away from our national fiscus between $6.5 billion and $29 billion per year. This is backed by research that is a reference in the paper. And indirect subsidies amount to between $35 million and $4.8 billion a year. So if we're going to align, can we please also redirect fossil fuel subsidies and align these to a low-carbon economy? Okay, 40 seconds. So we at WWF are standing up for a low-carbon transition and climate-resilient transition, of which the carbon tax is one tool, but we are very much looking for a just transition. So, yes, in a as your economy reorientates, some sectors will have to shrink, but please let us remember that many will grow, or there's the potential for many to grow, if we facilitate their growth and open our arms to them. So, you know, in such a transition, yes, we must provide social protection and decent managed transition for workers in high-emitting industries if they are to lose their jobs. And we must seek to create jobs all over the place. We have submitted papers to the Job Summit of all the opportunities for job creation that are there. We've also got a paper on low-carbon mining. So the mining sector does not need to necessarily shrink. It must mine the kinds of materials that a low-carbon economy needs. And we have a paper about, you know, what those are and which of them South Africa has good resources of. Just noting that the per ton mined issue that I think it was Sasol raised, if you're mining low-carbon products, then you're not going to be double-taxed because you won't get a high-carbon tax if you don't mine it in a high-carbon way. There's also great opportunities for localization and new kinds of manufacturing.
Can you please wrap
close
up?
Please, okay.
We're running out of time.
All right. So we stand up for a just transition, and we also base the needs on what the science says. Basically, if we want to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees, we have to act in the next 12 years, and we have to be net carbon zero around the world by 2050. And the impacts of 1.5 average global translates into double or more that in Africa, because we're warmer already. And those impacts will be felt the hardest by the poor. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. You referred to a paper there. You can give us a copy to Dr. Makalima. Jabulile, just put up your hand that you get this copy. You and Esther. Ota, Are you ready? OTA, here's their documents, members, this color one. After OTA, it is Business Unity SA. Are they here? Brilliant. I know. You see, you must always have a woman next to you.
Yes, Chair and honorable members, I'm Ronald Chauke from Outer. I'm the head of the energy portfolio. So I will take you through our inputs to the carbon tax bill. I will first look quickly at the introduction, the contextual background, and then our concerns, and then I will make the necessary recommendations as we agree. We are a civil society organization, and then our main aim is to ensure that we hold those in power accountable and make sure that the taxpayers' money is used efficiently and effectively. And then the tax is utilized to benefit us accordingly, rather than, like, for instance, taxes are just imposed and then make our lives even more miserable. So I will look into the global levels of emissions. As reported, we are almost at 32.1 billion, and then the International Energy Agency has indicated that the energy sector accounts for almost 90% of that. So, okay. I just wanted to pitch a slide all in one at the same time, but it seems not. So in terms of how we are operating from a South African environment, the important thing from an outer point of view as civil society, we say that we agree and support the notion of moving towards what we call a transition to a low carbon energy economy. However, that process has to be done in a much more orderly and in a much more fair way to enable us actually to take into account the needs of the country. For instance, you'll find that most of the developed economies, what they did in terms of their industrialization, they were more carbon intensive. It's the reality that we need to deal with. And then after they've done what you call their industrialization based on high carbon intensity, as the time goes on, then they said that, yeah, it's true, we need to transition to low carbon. So the question will be, we as South Africa, are we at that level as well to say that we are well developed, well industrialized, let's go towards a low transitional economy through, you know, low carbon. You might find that we are not yet ready at that level. So the South African share, as you can see in this slide, is that we are among the key emitters, of which we agree that we need to do something about it. And then the issue of carbon tax can be one of the policy instruments. However, we will talk about whether is it the appropriate one or the timing thereof. So this is what we did based on our analysis of the world environment. We realized that the emissions baseline data has not yet been collected as comprehensive as it's supposed to be, so that we may have industry standardization per each sector. And then we are having a challenge whereby we say that given the fact that when you want to introduce an instrument like a carbon tax, you need to take cognizance of the fact of driving behavioral change rather than, you know, going for an objective of raising revenues while it's increasing the tax burden. Because those by themselves, they compete against one another, and then they can end up being counterproductive and to the detriment of the country. So you need to look at the South African, what you call, economic development trajectory. Are we developing at the right rate, at the right pace? Are we addressing our historical social imbalances as well as other imperatives? If ever we are not balancing that, it means that more work still needs to be done in order to consider imposing an additional tax burden. That's how, from civil society point of view, we looked at it. And then we conducted our own research, and then we looked at how the policy intent of the carbon tax actually is all about. And then we tried to assess what benefits will accrue to ordinary South Africans as well as industries and the economic imperatives. And then in that matter, we found a lot of interesting things given the feedback that we received from various stakeholders, including the outer supporters whom we are representing, whereby they raised the matter of saying that we need actually to come to some arrangement in such a way that we balance how this whole exercise should be undertaken. For instance, we said that the current economic conditions are not favorable for us to impose a carbon tax. We said that we don't oppose the introduction of carbon tax as an instrument. However, we said that not at this point in time. Can we first fix the structural issues about our economy and the industries? Then we come up with a transitional plan to say that can we start to actually come up with a way of how to introduce carbon tax? Let's say, for instance, once our economy starts to pick up and develop at from 2% to 3% and onwards, then we introduce the carbon tax so that we don't stifle industrial development and industrialization as well as empowering our people by affording them economic opportunities for them to get jobs. Because, as I indicated, other industrialized countries, their basis of their industrialization and the revolution was based on high carbon production, and they were energy intensive. It's a reality. We can challenge that, but that's the truth. So if ever we will say that we are still an emerging economy, trying to build our capabilities to industrialize more so that we empower our people and then get the economic development levels higher. And then we say that, no, stop that, break it. Just follow the trajectory of how the European countries and other industrial economies are doing. Without first doing our own introspection, we might be making a big mistake. Because we need to take the reality of the contextual dynamics of the African environment and where we are as we speak now, before we can copy and paste whatever is happening in Europe, in America, in Asia, whatever the case may be. We might find ourselves saying that we agree with benchmarking. However, that benchmarking should actually help us to customize our policy development interventions and instruments based on our own realities, rather than saying that we just copy and paste. That's where we come from, because we are not necessarily against, you know, doing the right thing, because climate change is a reality. We are aware of that. However, we need to also be responsible to say that we want to take South Africa to the next level and then help South Africa to be a force to reckon with in terms of economic development, addressing our, you know, historical socio-economic imbalances and all other things like that. So it's very, very important that element of alignment, we can talk to it. So the other thing which we raised was the point of what we call, we need to sort out our due diligence about our readiness to implement a carbon tax. Are we ready to implement it as it is at this point in time, given our challenges? Or we need to do a much more broader work to make sure that the various socio-economic impacts are factored into our final decision. The other thing is that we recommend that National Treasury has to actually delay the introduction of the 9 cent per liter and 10 cent per liter for both petrol and diesel, respectively. We have a good reason for that. For instance, when you look at the current trajectory at which our fuel pricing is happening, people are not affording to the extent that actually our cost of doing business is more expensive, our cost of living is becoming even more worse, then is a tax punitive instrument a favorable intervention you can introduce at this point in time. You might find that if you are realistic, it might not be a wise move to do. We just have to be realistic. Because people now are starting to say that, how do we handle high energy price increases versus our low cost of our high cost of living?
For 2 minutes.
Yes, thanks, Chair. So all in all, we say that, can we do a proper diagnosis? For instance, when we talk about alignment, you'll find that now the Department of Energy is reviewing what we call the petrol price. Does this take into account that the petrol price on its own is becoming unaffordable? Or is about Treasury saying that, no, we need to meet our revenue generation target? So it means that the Treasury objective versus the energy objective of ensuring security of supply and affordability can be contrasting one another. So we implore you as policymakers to say, please, let us have an objective engagement about this in the national interest, rather than looking at it from one sector to say that it's revenue generation versus the detriment of our people's standard of living improving and then getting better. So on that note, we recommend that let's have a frank engagement, and then we make sure that all parties sit around the table, and then from a policy point of view, we try to find a common ground of how can we take the country forward, and then make sure that all the interested and affected parties are given room to give their input. Then transitional arrangement be put in place, and then we can determine how the carbon tax and other measures can help us to move forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. To OTA, there's one sentence I missed. Ignite economic growth.
That's true. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you for your confirmation. Business Unity South Africa, are you ready? Members, this document, Mark Kim. We are very well on time, members. That's great. And as we go along, you write down your questions. That's the members now. If you're ready, you may proceed. 15 minutes to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to get your indulgence on a particular issue. We've got two slots of BUSA, one now and one a little bit later on. We would like to request if we could combine that, so that we have a combined presentation on the customs and excise as well as the carbon tax bill. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you for the opportunity here today to speak on the draft carbon tax bill. Our presentation is going to be split into three parts. We're going to focus on the draft carbon tax bill first, and then I'm going to hand over to our mining colleagues to give us a view of the impact of the carbon tax on the mining sector, and then I'd like to get my colleague, who is a tax expert, to talk to us about the customs and excise, and specifically the implications and some of our concerns regarding the Customs and Excise Act. First and foremost, who is BUSA? So BUSA is Business Unity South Africa. We are a confederation of business organizations, including chambers of commerce and industry, professional associations, corporate associations. We represent South African business on macroeconomic and high-level issues at both international and national level. We aim to ensure that business plays a constructive role in the country's economic growth, development, and transformation. And we also want to encourage and allow business to thrive, expand, and be competitive. As a principal representative of business in South Africa, we represent the views of our members of various statutory and non-statutory
businesses. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yes.
Seems to me you combined your presentation.
Yes.
Now, we don't have that combined presentation.
It's
We've
the same
got the two separate ones,
yes.
Members. Now you must be vigilant to follow.
Yes. It's the same slides, Chair.
Oh.
It's just it will follow one after the other, exactly as you see them.
Please mention the heading when you present.
Will do. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Chair. Okay. So firstly, I'd like to give you our position on climate change. A lot has been said here today, and I want to indicate to you that BUSA does support carbon pricing. We see it as part of a suite of measures to address the country's climate change transition, and we are also taking climate change very seriously. You've heard from our members here today about the various efforts we have put in place in terms of combating and trying to abate climate change over the many number of years before policy intervention. And that's an important point to remember, that in this discussion, it's about the carbon tax and specifically how that is designed that we are having a challenge with today. So notwithstanding, BUSA does have a number of serious concerns with the carbon tax bill, and we are in fact not supportive of the carbon tax bill as before you today. There has been a number of consultations, and like many members have said, we have been involved in the discussions over the many years this has been consulted on. However, there are three big buckets of concerns that have not been met. The first of which is the state of the economy. You've heard a lot about that here today. We are in a fragile state. There have been various assurances given from the highest levels of government around removing regulatory barriers and ensuring that we encourage investment as well as create employment. We believe the carbon tax does not help us do this. There's a number of challenges regarding policy certainty. The bill before you today has a four-year time horizon, and for carbon pricing, you need a medium to long-term view. Right now, you've heard about policy misalignment in terms of the carbon budget versus the carbon tax. These are serious concerns in terms of how business plans and in terms of how we invest. The moment we have policy uncertainty, what you sit with is deferring of investment and waiting to get that policy certainty, which means at a time when the economy is very fragile, we are unable to invest and do what is required of us to grow this economy. We are here as partners today to talk to you about the challenges that we face in terms of the carbon tax bill. Next slide, we're looking at the lack of policy alignment post-2022. I'm not going to belabor this point. It has been raised a number of times, but I think I would like to let you know that the carbon tax is being put forward today and is wanting to regulate every ton of emissions that a company emits. And that's important to note, every ton of emissions. We've got at the same time the Department of Environmental Affairs putting forward a carbon budgeting system, which is essentially putting a cap on emissions and saying to business, you are allowed to emit up to a certain point. But then you've got the same government saying to us, no, actually, we are going to tax you on that same ton. For business, this is a huge challenge in terms of how we plan and how we get alignment. What we are looking for is an integrated view. We have had many assurances over the many years that we've been discussing this, that there will be alignment. Even last year in the parliamentary process, we've been assured by government that there is a process to align. To date, we have not had one consultation on this. And right now, we run the risk of having two standalone instruments in the economy trying to regulate the same ton of emissions. And I say this because we're talking about the carbon tax bill here today, but through a separate process, which is NEDLAC, we are also talking about a draft climate change bill that is also proposing a carbon budgeting system that is even talking about criminalizing business for exceeding the budget. We are talking about a very complicated situation, and it puts us in a very precarious position where we are now deferring investment. So ultimately comes to the point that the state of the economy really can't afford for business to not be investing in the way that we should be, given already high costs to doing business. So BUSA requests that the carbon tax bill, at this point, needs to deal with the alignment. We cannot be in a position where the bill passes through and then through a separate process we try to get through alignment. This is something we need to deal with today because it has implications into the future. Let's consult and do what needs to be done in a meaningful way in order to get the best system for the country that works while we grow the economy and reduce emissions. Next slide, Chair. Critical issues to implementing the carbon tax. So in addition to some of the policy alignment issues between the budget and the tax, we also have the carbon tax itself, which has a number of gaps. We as BUSA have always been calling for that the draft carbon tax bill, together with all of its associated regulations, be promulgated at the same time. So we as the regulated entity can understand what our carbon tax liability is. currently we sit in a position where we have a framework legislation with a number of supporting regulations and announcements outstanding. We do not have a promulgated carbon offset regime, so we are unable to calculate how we will utilize this allowance. We do not have a trade exposure regulation. We don't have a performance benchmark regulation. Whilst BUSA has been consulted on the approach through this process, we are still yet to see the regulations. And with any other regulation, there will be consultation, there will be discussions, there will be moments of disagreement. We have got 2 months before the carbon tax becomes implemented. So I want to remind the members that 1 June 2019 is 2 months away effectively without all of the supporting regulations being in place so that we as the tax-paying entity or the liable entity can fully understand what your implications are in terms of the carbon tax. This is a serious challenge for us in planning for the carbon tax, in trying to understand what your long-term exposure is, in terms of planning to do something about this. So from a mitigation perspective, but also from a capital outlay, from an investment perspective. We must also bear in mind, as was mentioned by many others, that the carbon tax is about taxing carbon emissions. So ultimately what we are looking at is the foundational legislation is the greenhouse gas reporting regulations, which need to be fully operational for us to be able to have a system against which you can measure your carbon tax liability. I want to also remind everyone that the greenhouse gas reporting regulations were promulgated in 2017. We are still submitting manual submissions. There is no system right now that's operational that allows us to verify our carbon tax. So all of these issues mean that there's a lack of alignment, lack of certainty between all of the different approaches, requirements to make the carbon tax implementable by 1 June 2019. These are serious challenges for us as the regulated entity. So taxpayers have no certainty regarding allowances. We cannot determine our tax liability, and this impacts at both the provincial as well as the national level. Some serious concerns. We move on to the next slide. We're looking at increasing costs in a fragile economy. And here we are really talking about the ultimate impact. The biggest consequence here is we've got the triple challenges of poverty, inequality, and unemployment, all critical priorities that even at the presidential level, there are various processes underway about encouraging investment as well as employment. We believe the carbon tax will have implications even at the grassroots level. It will impact the poorest. It will raise the cost of electricity further. There have been assurances made by National Treasury about electricity price neutrality. That is on direct emissions. All of the input costs will all rise because we will transfer costs over. Business will transfer costs over. This means transport costs go up. It means all your input costs go up. It means that even at food level, basic food level, costs will go up. There are serious implications, and I'm going to hand over to our mining colleagues to take you through a particular example of what this means for jobs and for investment in the economy in the short term. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We represent the mining industry, and there's some work we did towards this. I'll be presenting on a time series econometric analysis, particularly the impact on jobs of the carbon tax on jobs. And my colleague here, Tafazo, will be doing the cost curves analysis. In terms of what we do, the work of some of the work that we do, we have some booklets here, facts and figures. It's basically a publication, small pocketbook that we publish every year of what of the kind of work that we do. So we starting with the So in terms of our contribution to GDP, we contributed about that is last year about 312 billion rands to GDP, which is about 7%. Total contribution to GDP. We employed about 460,000 people, representing about 6.1% of private non-agricultural employment. In terms of investment, we contributed about 93 billion to fixed investment, which is about 18.2% of private sector fixed investment. In fact, that is almost triple of what we contribute in terms of GDP. In terms of export earnings, which contribute to the forex reserve of the country, we earned 307 billion, just to show how important the sector is in the economy. So we want to grow it instead of coming with policies that will inhibit growth. We do pay taxes. Last year we paid 16 billion in terms of corporate income tax. It was 7.5 billion in terms of royalties. We also pay, our employees pay Payers UN, so we do contribute to the fiscus. In terms of the analysis, the basic argument is mining is a marginal business. A slight increase in input costs results in the closure of some operations. Last year, a number of operations closed just on account of the strengthening of the rand. So we are a marginal business. The second point that I want to make is that we are also price takers. An increase in input cost, we cannot transfer that to the final price of the product. These are the assumptions that back the work that we've done. But I want to focus on this chart here. This is a chart where we modeled the 10 cents per liter CO2 tax on liquid fuels. And we've done that in terms of the backward linkages on the productive sectors. First of all is that mining, I want to stress that mining, the mining sector has a jobs multiplier of 2.8%. That is for every one person, one job in the mining sector, three people are employed elsewhere in the economy. In terms of the total indirect number of people that are employed as a result of the mining sector, that's about 1.3 million people, that was in 2017. And most of these indirect jobs are created in the transport sector. So what is the impact then of the 10 cents per liter carbon CO2 tax? We see that we modeled this on 2017 production and employment statistics. So instead of employing 462,000 people, 871 in 2017, those that would have been employed as a result of this tax would have been less. In fact, it would have been 459,168 people. In terms of total indirect employment, it would have declined by 10,441. So we see the impact of the tax. Basically, what the chart then does, we show the levels of employment, indirect employment, but we also show the impact of the 10 cents per liter CO2 tax on liquid fuels. So that's the yellow tax there, which shows the decline in the number of jobs, indirect jobs as a result of the mining sector. But I want to talk about then the last rectangle there at the bottom, that the number of jobs lost as a result of the 10 cents per liter CO2 tax would have been 10,441, as I mentioned earlier. But we had to then take out the fact that we still, as a mining sector, receive a diesel fuel refund. And that diesel fuel refund helps to retain 3,605 jobs. So that's a good thing on the part of the state to give us that, to have that refund. This then makes the net job losses to be just over 6,800. So that's the impact of the CO2, of the 10 cents per liter CO2 tax on liquid fuels. We then did this was presented last year when we were here. It's basically to say in phase two, we know that in this phase, we do not have the carbon tax is price, electricity price neutral, let's put it that way. So, but we then said in phase two then, what would happen? We assumed a 5% increase in the price of electricity. What we see is the outcome in terms of production is the outcome in terms of investment. The one that I want to focus on is investment, because without investment, there are no jobs. What it shows there is that if the tax had been applied, introduced in 2000, on average, investment would have declined. On average per year, investment would have declined by about 5 billion. So that would take away jobs, or jobs that would not have been created. And this last slide on my part just shows the job losses in terms of the if electricity were to increase by 5%,
as a result of the CO2 tax. I'll now ask my colleague Tafa to do the presentation on cost caps.
Thank you, Chair, and honourable members. I think what I will do is just put some numbers, because what we've heard from many in the room is the precarious position which mining finds itself, as well as the economy. But I'll just put some numbers to that as well. And I think what I would like for us to keep in mind is the number that was mentioned by my colleague Bongani, that every mining job induces 2.8 jobs in the economy. More important to that is the fact that the dependency ratio of a mining job is anything from 7 to 10 people relying on a mining job. This is family, etc. So a mining job is important. So we can give absolute numbers right now, but the cascading effect of this is quite significant. Another point I want to make, and then really what I will just do is show from the way the industries that are currently most in distress and that would be most impacted by this, by the introduction of a tax. One point I want to make, and Morgani have mentioned it, is that the industry is a price taker, so we can't transfer our costs into our selling prices. That's important. But most important is that, so mining companies then only have, they can only then control their input costs, which of course a carbon tax would be one. That's number one. And the other important point is to say mining decisions are 20, 30 years. So essentially, from an investment point of view, anything that introduces uncertainty really deters any prospects for investment. What we've included here, and this analysis also can be cascaded to all other sectors of industries within the mining sector, we've taken our most cost-sensitive industries, and in there we are looking at gold and coal. My apologies, gold and PGM. In total, they employ about 62% of mining employment. And essentially, the current position, before any additional taxes have been included, before the ESCOM increases have been factored in, Chair, what we are looking at is 69% of gold operations right now are currently marginal or unsustainable. And in PGM, we're looking at about 52%. Now, that's the current scenario as it is right now. Important is that when we refer to marginal there, what we are talking to is your companies that are producing within a 6% tunnel between cost and price. So already when you are in that tunnel, decisions have to be made around the sustainability of an operation. What you have essentially on that slide, on the next slide, is what we call cost curves. It won't be clear on that slide, but in our written submission, we have included it. Essentially, all mines producing to the right of the line are unsustainable, and essentially that we are talking in excess of about 50,000 people currently in gold mining, and as well as about 90,000 people in PGM. And again, if you consider the multiplier, the multiplier as well as the dependency ratios, Chair, that's something we can't stress enough. And then lastly, the point we also want to make is around, this now talks to the total mining sector. And what we measure there as well, is another way of looking at sustainability is to compare input costs and selling price. This is the inflation. I won't talk through the detail of each year, but essentially what you would look at is that on average, input costs have gone up by double that of selling prices. What that essentially means is margin squeeze, balance sheet pressure, as well as decisions about mining operations, whether to keep them open or closed. Now, the point then we want to make is, as was made earlier on, is that in a country that emits in excess or just under 1.5% of global emissions, adding a cost that has all the issues that have been raised by a number of our colleagues, in the current environment, we believe it wouldn't be the wisest to do. But at this point, Chair, I'll now hand over to our colleague to deal with the Customs and Excise Bill.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. BUSA appreciates the opportunity to make further comments on the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill. Now, BUSA has consistently raised concerns about the use of the Customs and Excise Act as an instrument for the implementation of this new tax. Now, the fact that we're still talking about it so much further down the line, I guess that ship has sailed, and the Customs and Excise Act is what it is, and we have to deal with it. But the question is, can we make it work? And the more important question is, are we ready? Is the Act in a position where we can say it's ready for implementation on the 1st of June 2019? And I can tell you, having practiced in the world of customs and excise for the last 18, 19 years, the answer is a fundamental no. because we have one section that's covering what the tax is going to be. We don't have a sight of the rules. We have no idea what's going to be finding its way into the rules. The suggestion is that the rules will be published for comment by the end of March. If that is to be so, are 2 months sufficient for business, for industry, for South Africa to comment on? Are these rules going to work? Are they going to be practically implementable? BUSA's concern is that all of our concerns have not been addressed up until this point. Yes, because we haven't seen the rules. And are we ready? As I said, the answer is no, from a customs perspective in any event. And BUSA's concern is that if these issues are not addressed, we're going to find that we have a carbon tax that's going to be implemented and become law, and it will be impossible to implement from a practical perspective, from the point of view of the customs legislation. Now, policy certainty is critical if we are if we're going to ensure that we encourage investment, if we encourage foreign direct investment. And how are we going to address this if there's so much uncertainty around where the Act is going, how the rules are going to read? The amendment bill does not pass the test of regularity and certainty, and I will not bore you with too much detail, but I want to explain to you why it is that we say that it's not in a position of readiness. The word alignment or misalignment is a swear word today, but you're going to hear it from me again, and please bear with me. So if we move to slide 2, the proposed amendments fail to make obligations clear. So that section that we've seen that's been published already for comment, section 54, capital A, it refers to imported and manufactured goods. Greenhouse gas emissions, which are dispersed to the atmosphere, are not manufactured and imported. And why is that important? References to greenhouse gas emissions as goods creates an incorrect impression that emissions can be measured and audited in the same way as any tangible goods. Now, SARS people in the room, the word audit gets you excited and you know, you'll start to feel some energy and flowing through your veins. But please ask yourself, how are you going to audit this from the 1st of June 2019? We don't know. The second comment that we'd like to make is section 54, capital D. It refers to a discretionary power of the minister to provide a rebate, refund, or drawback of any environmental levy. Now, this is fundamentally different from the allowances which must be paid to eligible taxpayers in terms of the carbon tax bill. So we must stress that point, because the allowances which must be paid to eligible taxpayers in terms of the carbon tax bill cannot be dealt with by the provisions in the current customs and excise bill. And I leave you with that thought. The next comment is in relation to section 54, capital E, and it deals with the licensing of premises, which implies that there will be different carbon tax accounts for each licensed premises. Now, BUSA has been harping on about this since I can remember, ever since we've been trying to get the comment across, that the tax cannot be implemented and policed per licensed warehouse. And we also see that there is now a contradistinction between what the carbon tax bill proposes and what the customs and excise amendment bill is proposing. So there again, please look at the alignment. We need to ensure that the intention of the carbon tax bill, which is to tax a single taxpayer, must be aligned to the reporting entity in terms of the greenhouse gas reporting regulations. And then we've got the third piece of regulation, which is the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill, which talks about the warehousing and the licensing of the actual facility. So there again, a misalignment which seriously needs to be addressed.
5 minutes left.
Moving quickly to slide 3, the rules to section 54 do not address the manner in which a taxpayer must submit their yearly tax returns and environmental levy accounts and payments. So please, again, a misalignment between the accounting period for customs purposes and that not being aligned with what the carbon tax bill is setting out as being an annualized submission of returns. This kind of confusion needs to be addressed urgently, otherwise we can't see how taxpayers are going to meet these obligations. And moving to slide 4, a critical issue is the penalty provisions of the Customs and Excise Act as it stands. The current Act, 1964, it's in a state of flux. It's due to be replaced by new legislation in due course. But as it stands, as we speak today, the penalty provisions in the Customs and Excise Act are archaic, they are draconian. There's no way that that can be practically implemented in a situation where there's uncertainty from a taxpayer's point of view as to how they're going to meet the requirements. And it's a scary thought that if Treasury cannot stick to or come to the party insofar as its agreements and statements in June 2018, We are concerned that the penalty provisions are too drastic. We implore Treasury to please look at your comments of June 2018, where you said that consideration could be given to the level of accuracy of the emissions estimates that would be acceptable without incurring a penalty, please. For example, the 80-20 principle that's applied for provisional tax payments, please give it some thought so that taxpayers can actually know what their obligations are and meet them happily. We understand that there's a climate change problem, but how do we meet our obligations if we don't understand them? A bit about the misalignment. As I said, I'm running out of time, so basically the four points that we'd like to address are that the carbon taxpayer must be identical to the greenhouse gas reporting entity to allow verification of tax liability. The second one, the basis of the carbon tax must be the same as the quantum of the greenhouse gas emissions reported to the DEA. The management of the allowances must not lead to additional administrative burdens, please. And the deduction of the carbon tax as an input cost must be easily achieved. I mean, it's one more burden. Happy to meet it, but make it as easy as possible and as clear as possible for business. I think the last and the most important aspect of our submission, the proposal for amendment to the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill, BUSA is of the view that the allowances and limitation of allowances must be calculated by the taxpayer in terms of that act, must be offset against the environmental levy account, please. The reason we're steering away from rebates, refunds, drawbacks, it's simply not working. As a practitioner in the coal face and dealing with SARS, on a daily basis on the claiming of rebates and refunds, all we end up doing is 6-7 year court battles because SARS fights us on commas and words and interpretation of legislation. Unfortunately, that is a factor of SARS wanting to do its job and us having to protect industry. So to make it easier for all concerned, we would like to steer away from rebates, refunds, and drawbacks. And the last comment, and also an important one, a taxpayer as defined in the Carbon Tax Act must register with SARS in a manner which will ensure that this registration of the taxpayer is linked to the registration of the taxpayer as a data provider in terms of the greenhouse gas reporting regulations and prescribed by rule. So again, we're trying to make sure there's an alignment between the three regulators. Let's all speak the same language and move towards in the same direction for this to be practically workable from the 1st of June. Thank you.
Thank you to BUSA. You know who's making money? The lawyers. If you start running to court, they are smiling.
That's
all
exactly
the way
the
to
point
the bank.
That I'm trying to make about the refund.
Try and solve this around the table. Why is that not possible? Maybe the SOP must assist in that exercise, all the members. Yes. Right. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Chemical and Allied Industries Association. Are they here? There they are. Brilliant. And after that, Kosatu.
Chair, thank you very much, and honourable members, for the opportunity today. Once again, we as CAIA, the Chemical Allied Industries Association, is an association that represents the entire value chain of the chemical industry, right from the start of manufacturing, right through to waste and soil response companies. So it's the entire value chain. And we have been involved with this right from the very beginning as well, and have provided numerous written submissions and verbal submissions. And we've worked very closely with the department, and I want to say thank you very much for that, but there are still some outstanding matters. We also represent, one of my colleagues earlier also spoke about the representation within the membership. We sit with DAL, BASF, the SAFLs of the world, etc., who are big contributors worldwide, DAL being the largest chemical industry in the world, and BASF the second. So we have a lot of expertise, we have a lot to offer, I'm going to hand over to Glenn Malova, who is head of policy analysis within CAIA. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, committee. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for the opportunity to present our views on the carbon tax bill. As mentioned by Deirdre, the association confirms that it does not support the introduction of the tax, and we would also like to raise outstanding matters. I would firstly like to highlight the importance of the chemical sector to the economy and to jobs, also having been recognized recently as one of the 20 sectors that are crucial to accelerating GDP growth, as identified through the private-public growth initiative under the presidency. We must remember that chemicals are essential to health, quality of life, and social and economic development, contributing very strongly to the economy. And almost all value chains in economies around the world. The economic contribution is very strong, 3% to GDP and around 23% to manufacturing, although this is falling due to the increasing regulatory and economic instruments. This affects competitiveness and the cost of doing business. We also have a very strong multiplier effect on GDP and the economy, with around 12 times on employment and 5.5 times on GDP. CAIA is the custodian of the Global Voluntary Responsible Care Initiative in South Africa. It's a voluntary commitment made by members of the association to sustainability. For CAIA members, the carbon tax bill has an implication on where there are greenhouse gas emissions as identified by the National Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reporting Regulations. And these are fugitive emissions, waste emissions, industrial process emissions, as well as combustion emissions. CAIA has been involved in consultations since the very beginning of the process and heeded the call by the Davis Tax Committee to provide inputs on the scope of the tax, and we have been opposing it since then. CAIA still cannot support the implementation of a carbon tax for South Africa. But what are our main concerns? Indeed, several concerns still need to be addressed. Although assessments and modelling work have been undertaken by the National Treasury, the assessments do not comprehensively consider the potential negative socio-economic impacts, such as on inflation through the addition of the tax to the fuel price. The tax is not meant to impact the vulnerable and the poor, but we believe that the inflationary impact of the carbon tax will have a negative effect on inflation and therefore will definitely impact the consumer. This has even been recognized by the National Treasury, And furthermore, the National Treasury has also recognized the importance of companies to the economy, the need for growth and long-term planning, and the difficulty in assessing the impact of the tax, given the uncertainty also posed through the lack of finalization of the full suite of legislation. CHI feels that the full suite of climate change-related legislation has not been fully considered in terms of impact on the economy. Within the proposed legislation of the National Treasury itself, stakeholders, although consulted on the approaches, still haven't seen the draft regulations on trade exposure nor performance allowances, and we eagerly await those. We'd like to stress that without the full suite of legislation to consider, policy certainty is lacking due to the assumptions that business needs to make. CHI argues that the tax aims to change behavior and set a price on GHG emissions. But it's punitive where there's no choice for a consumer to be able to change their behavior, such as in the liquid fuel sector. CHI doesn't support a tax that's not ring-fenced, even though we know the views of Treasury. Taxes should be used to effectively address challenges that are not managed through normal market mechanisms. Although the National Treasury has attempted to provide policy certainty where possible, and mostly within the first phase of the tax up to 2022, we believe it's insufficient to foster a healthy environment conducive to investor and business certainty. A recent proposal by the National Treasury proposes a very different tax regime after 2022. And studies undertaken by business before this proposal was on the table showed uncertainty that resulted in a very wide range of potential impacts on the economy. Companies in the chemical sector have for many, many years been voluntarily undertaking climate change mitigation projects, up to some companies reducing their greenhouse gas emissions by more than 90%. These companies will still have a carbon tax liability going forward with the carbon tax, even although there's no technological solution to reduce their emissions further. So this has been voluntary investment and commitment.
4 minutes.
Thank you. The tax is to be administered by an environmental levy requiring registration, and these challenges have been raised before. Consultation. Sorry, let me change the slide. Consultation on this has not yet begun with the National Treasury in order to make this as without burden as possible. It remains unclear to CHIA if the carbon tax is tax deductible or not, with there being different views within the private sector on this matter. We must remember that the carbon tax will be implemented as an environmental levy, and environmental levies are not tax deductible. Further challenge is that despite the statement in the draft legislation that a tax can be placed on imports, there is no information as yet as to how that may be achieved in the future. This is very important to maintain the competitiveness of our products. A further administrative challenge is that certain emissions in the waste sector are liable, even although there is 100% tax-free allowance. those emissions will still need to go through the administrative registration and licensing process, which we believe in is an administrative burden at this time. Furthermore, and starting to close off, carbon offsets, we're all calling for further flexibility in that legislation. There's a maximum 10% allowance on that, and that could represent the best opportunity for companies to achieve least cost mitigation. It's quite restrictive in terms of the allowance as well as what projects can be undertaken. Finally, Chair, valid reservations that are indicated in the Standing Committee on Finance report should also be taken into account by this committee when considering the matter. In conclusion, there's many outstanding matters that still need to be considered. For this to happen by 1 June is most likely not possible, and we would really like to see further engagement taking place. And in closing, I trust that this committee will agree that the implementation of the tax should not go ahead, and that future engagements will consider how to balance social, economic, and environmental imperatives more effectively than a tax going forward in these discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the team for your presentation. Just to our colleagues from SARS that's present here on page 3 or 5. Now, we've got this presentation. We didn't receive the slide presentation. Administration of the tax through the Customs and Excise Act. You just look at that 1, 2, 3 bullets there, please. Thank you. Next, Kusatu. Kusatu, you've got your 15 minutes. We are well on time, honorable members. Thank you for your cooperation to accomplish that. You ready? You may proceed.
Yes,
Parks,
thanks.
Parks and Commandant.
Yes, no, thanks very much.
Very patient, sitting here since half past 9 this morning. Yeah.
we come to learn and to listen and to be convinced. So, no, thanks very much, Chairperson. And, yeah, good afternoon to colleagues, to members. My name is Matthew Parks from the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and I'm joined by my colleague, Comrade Tony Ehrenreich. So yes, we thank the committee for giving us space to raise the concerns of COSATU, our unions, our members. And I think we're taking a slightly different stance than some of the presenters this morning, Chair, both from industry and from government. We want to see a win-win approach. We recognize the realities of climate change. There's a need to deal with it. It has a huge impact upon working class communities across the nation. There's a need for urgent action to deal with climate change. Chair, I don't think you'll often hear COSATU saying viva to our tax, so don't expect us to say viva to the carbon tax. But we recognize why government uses taxes to try to change industry behavior. Chair, equally, we are concerned with the lack of a government jobs plan and a lack of a just transition plan to move the nation forward. And we'll present some of our proposals as COSATU, Chair. Chair, we know, even during the public hearings last year at Parliament on the carbon tax bill, we had many people who wanted to deny the reality of climate change. We don't want to go down that route of denialism. We saw what happened when we entertained those debates during the AIDS crisis not so long ago. It is a reality, Chair. You are from Namaqualand. You know very well. In Cape Town, we've seen the water crisis. We've seen the acid mine water crisis in Gauteng. We've seen the pollution in urban and industrial areas in Mpumalanga. Our mine workers in the Northern Cape die at a very early age because of asbestos poisoning. Skin cancer, it's a disaster. The flood levels are rising. We also recognize, Chair, that as taxpayers, the state is burdened by dealing with the health, the environmental crises, etc. And this is denying money where it's needed more. Chair, we're in a very difficult spot. For example, our National Union of Mine Workers, our mining affiliate, has long championed the need to deal with climate change, to champion renewable energy. Yet because of state capture, looting at Eskom, the kind of negligence of both government and industry to deal with these issues, mine workers are facing job threats across the board. We had a situation where Eskom wanted to close coal plants in Mpumalanga and throw 5,000 coal workers into unemployment. We're now seeing Eskom workers being threatened with huge levels of retrenchment in the very, very imminent future. Chair, even when we deal with the issue of coal industry, we recognize we do need to move from coal industry in the long term. It's going to have a devastating impact to towns in Mpumalanga, to coal workers, and even to transport and other workers whose jobs depend upon this thing if it's not dealt with properly. Chair, look, we recognize why Treasury wants a carbon tax. We recognize the need to punish those companies who are polluting, etc. And I think, Chair, it's not often that we will acknowledge work done by Treasury, but we do recognize that they have made concessions on the carbon tax. They've reduced the initial levels. We know the NGOs are not happy with that. But we also appreciate, Chair, that exemptions have been provided for agriculture, which is very important, as the largest employer of low-skilled workers, in fact, of all workers outside the public sector. But I think, Chair, where we have to also make an emphasis is that the mining industry is very fragile. We've seen 72,000 jobs lost in the last 2 years, and on a monthly basis, we see mining companies retrenching not hundreds, but thousands of workers. It's an extremely fragile industry right now, Chair. Chair, we're also worried that government is not having other plans to deal with climate change besides just the tax. We think the Department of Environmental Affairs and other departments have been very soft are coming with serious action plans. We're also worried that government has a tendency, and we know Treasury's job is to raise revenue, but it seems that government's only approach to deal with issues is raising taxes. We don't see a serious government jobs plan, and in fact, Chair, in the budget tables last month in Parliament, only about 5 out of the 40 government departments tabled any jobs plans. Yet we have 37% of workers unemployed and rising. Chair, we would really want to see an emphasis from both government and industry around a just transition plan. I think, Chair, we must acknowledge and appreciate the role that this committee and the Standing Committee on Finance and the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs played by forcing government to engage with business and industry and labour at NEDLAC. I think we supported the jobs plan that came out of NEDLAC. We support the presidential job summit plans. And these are quite useful plans, Chair, because they come with clear sectoral interventions by government, by industry. Key amongst them, Chair, is the need to reskill workers who will be affected by climate change and to absorb them in other areas. And there is funds available in government for this purpose. Chair, we think, for example, we all know Eskom is a thing which threatens to collapse the state. It's in a massive life and death crisis. We think there are ways to save Eskom, to achieve government's climate change objectives and to create jobs. One of them is to allow Eskom to itself enter the renewable energy production field. Tremendous license. We think, Chair, Eskom can be brought to a stage where the tariffs can be more affordable. We can once again start exporting electricity to the continent and, in fact, drive the continent's industrialization. Eskom right now, because of the hooligans who have brought it to the verge of collapse, has made electricity so unaffordable neighboring states no longer want to buy from us. Chair, again, electric vehicles. We are fortunate to have an vehicle industry with about 8 companies producing vehicles here. Yet there's no plan from government and industry to start producing electric vehicles, be it cars, buses, bikes, etc. locally. And other countries are moving very fast. China's producing about 1 million electric vehicles a year. If we continue to sleep, we'll miss out on that train. And that's a huge opportunity to grow the economy, to save Eskom, and to meet the climate change targets. We're really missing the boat, Comrade Chair. Chair, again, renewable energy technology is fascinating. It's growing by leaps and bounds. You have Tesla producing tiles for roofs which are linked to solar panels. It can make electricity affordable for consumers, and if we're able to manufacture these things locally for domestic and for foreign use, we can grow the economy and create new jobs. And in fact, Chair, we've seen in the past few years how some of our solar panel factories in Stellenbosch and Cape Town have closed because of the threat of Chinese imports coming in, and there's been a lack of effort by government to save these chaps. Chair, the water crisis is a fantastic opportunity for us to save water, to save the environment, to meet the climate change targets, and to grow jobs from conservation to recycling, etc., to the JoJo tanks, even though I believe Johan Rupert has got shares there, but there's a chance to grow that industry and to export it to the continent. When you have 50% of our country being water scarce permanently, the rest under pressure as well. Again, Chair, the fishing communities are devastated by climate change, depleting stocks. If we are serious as a government, as industry, we can actually save it by investing in aquaculture. But again, we seem to want to pontificate and not get on with the job. Chair, public transport is one of the key intervention areas we need to focus on for jobs and for climate change targets. Our trains are collapsing. I think Comrade Tony spent half his life and half his grey hairs intervening around Metro Rail's collapse. We don't see a plan in government's budget to save Metro Rail. That's a key way of getting people out of cars onto trains. In fact, we've seen the train stock declining, and even when governors bought trains, they bought trains which are too tall or too short or whatever the story is. Electric vehicles, again, Chair, is an opportunity. Chair, if we look internationally, other countries are moving fast forward. They're even nowadays, Chair, might sound funny, but nowadays the US, Netherlands are painting roads white because it helps to absorb heat emissions, and again, another target to reduce climate change. And again, Chair, it's a way to actually save the paint industry here, to create quick jobs, etc. But again, we must be creative. The same goes for biofuels, Comrade Chair. Chair, we've made a lot of attention on the issue of land in the past few years correctly, but again, we have very little focus as a nation around how to deal with the effects of deforestation, desertification. What about growing gardening cities? China, for example, is building gardens on top of all buildings as part of reducing heating. You remember when Comrade Kader Asma was the Minister of Water Affairs in 94? He did fantastic work about dealing with alien vegetation. Chair, you don't need to be a rich country to do these things. We've got countries like Mali, China, planting millions of trees a year. Again, creates jobs, rehabilitates the land, will grow agriculture long term, deals with climate change. These are not difficult things if we have the political will. Chair, as much as we want to acknowledge the mining sector is very fragile and we need it, but I think the mining industry must also come to the party. We've seen too many mines, when they've come to the end of the term, are abandoned. There is a serious need for the Department of Mineral Resources to wake up and to push industry around the rehabilitation of mines, to deal with the issue of acid mine water, and so on, Chair. Chair, one of the most exciting opportunities to create jobs, and again to meet the climate change objectives, is around recycling, both at an industrial level and at a consumer level. Most of our municipal waste sites are full at 100%. You see our cities across the nation, not just Joburg, but every city. It's filthy. We really have no plan as a nation, whether it's industry or government, around recycling. The recycling levels right now are dangerously low. And this is a chance, Chair, to create new jobs, new sectors for the unemployed. And you can see it from plastic to glass, et cetera, Chair. Chair, I think we'd also want to really see industry leading and government supporting them to use more sustainable methods of technology, from agriculture to forestry to construction, cement, etc., even to clothing, Chair. There's new research available that shows how we can do things smarter, create more jobs and save the environment. I think, Chair, we'll come to this afternoon in the PIC hearings, but the PIC must also come to the party and start investing in ways to support green industry, green jobs. It can't be business as usual for all of us. Chair, we know that Treasury loves to raise revenues and taxes, and they don't like this thing of, ring fencing, but we do want to see a commitment from government and actually doing it to take that carbon tax revenues and invest it in the green economy. It can't just be a question of taking here and not giving here. We'd want to see some creative ideas from DTI, from economic development, etc., to support green job creation and incentives. Chair, you know, we've also had a huge issue with Treasury and government that they're quick to raise revenues, but they're very slow to come with plans to cushion the poor from the impact upon those tax hikes. from VAT to the sugar to now the carbon tax, etc. We really need to see more efforts besides just exempting sanitary pads, for example, from these tax hikes. You know, workers really are seeing their income levels being battered and being squeezed dry at all times. So in conclusion, Chair, I think maybe the last point you want to make is that the Standing Committee on Finance, I think 2 weeks ago or a week ago, made a very progressive resolution as part of their handover report to the sixth parliament. We want this committee to also do a similar resolution, and we as COSAT will help chase the sixth parliament and whichever members come back to action it. But it is to require that government report to parliament on a quarterly basis on the implementation of the job summit plans, as well as the carbon tax, the sugar tax, and other job plans. Government shouldn't be allowed just to simply raise taxes and then not to implement the job creation plan. So I think, Chair, we would really want to see that, and it doesn't need to just be the finance committees, but it should be a sectoral approach with DCI, environmental affairs, etc., Chair. But we want to see an activist parliament come into play, Chairperson. So, yeah, that's our presentation in a nutshell, Chairperson, and we've tried to make it a win-win approach. Save the environment, the planet, we must do it, but equally we need to save jobs and to grow the economy at the same time, Chairperson. Thanks very much.
As a matter of fact, I already spoke to the chair of the portfolio committee on trade and industry, Honorable Fox, that we do things differently in the sixth parliament. Whoever comes back, but there's a legacy report to follow. So thank you for this recommendation. Thank you to the presenters for session two. Honorable members, on our program is indicated that we have a break now and then go to the deliberations on these presentations just made. Do you concur with that? Can I get some reply? Okay. We suspend the proceedings and then we will continue at 1:45. Thank you.
Thank you.